You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Dr. Wes Bellamy, who is a city councilman here in the city of Charlottesville, Virginia. He has been a leading advocate for the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee that was the focus of a racist riot here in 2017. Wes Bellamy has just published a book called Monumental. It was never about a statue. Dr. Bellamy, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, good brother. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for doing what you're doing. Thanks for writing this book. I think, some good news, we just saw that Corey Stewart, the Republican Senate candidate who rallied around that statue, has left politics.
Amen.
Amen. So it wasn't about a statue. What was it about?
Well, in my opinion, I think that the white supremacist attacks that occurred in August 12th weren't about the Robert E. Lee statue. In fact, it was about a history within our community, within our state, within our nation to a certain extent, in which I think we have forgotten to a certain extent. I think that we sometimes believe that we are much further along than we actually are. When you think about the election of President Obama, I think people thought that we were in this post-racial society without acknowledging the fact that there are still a lot of hateful and mean people who are still within our community. When you look at the fact that these individuals who decided to come to Charlottesville, their leaders, have been very clear in saying that they believe that they wanted to take back what was theirs. They believe that Charlottesville, Virginia as a whole, is their city, is their town, is their state. And they are the dominant force. They are the dominant culture. They are the superior beings. And they believed that any kind of disruption to that ideology or an empowerment of any other groups of people, even if they look like themselves, is indeed something that makes them feel as if they're under attack. They believe that diversity is the equivalent to genocide. They believe that when we say that we're going to move statues, we're going to empower people, we're going to create equitable spaces, it makes them feel very threatened. And they have felt comfortable to be able to express their views by a variety of different things. So when I say, you know, it's not about a statue, it's about a multitude of things that led to August 12th and things that were taking place before August 12th, before we said that we wanted to move forward with moving the statues back in March of 2016 before I got on council. This is generations and decades in the making, and it all came to a head on that day. But I believe that we are a much stronger community because of it, and we are, in fact, ground zero for the awakening.
So correct me if I'm wrong. I think there are two things that are both true. One, that racism has always been alive and well here in Charlottesville, and most of those people on August 12, 2017 actually came here from far away. Are both of those right?
I think that your first point was right. Racism has always been prevalent, but I mean, we have to keep in mind, this is we're literally celebrating this year 400 years after the first enslaved African was brought to Jamestown here in Virginia. So, I mean, our state has been embedded with this systemic oppression for literally hundreds of years. And then to the second point in regards to these people weren't necessarily from Charlottesville, while I agree many of them may not have been from the city, I mean, Kessler lived here in Charlottesville. He was a graduate of UVA. Richard Spencer is a graduate of UVA. I mean, a lot of the folks who were here were, in fact, from either Charlottesville, surrounding areas. Yeah, obviously, a lot of them came from places throughout the country. But I think it gives us an escape when we say, oh, those people aren't from here. That doesn't represent our community. But in fact, I mean, there are people who share that ideology who live right here in our community. I can tell you this because I get Facebook messages, emails, letters to my home, and all kinds of stuff from people right here who share that ideology and tell me that I'm every kind of N-word that you can think of. So,
right.
I mean, yeah, while, again, a lot of them were from outside, many of them were from here.
What I was interested in reading your book, Monumental, it was never about a statue, that you were working on what some people would call more substantive issues at the same time as working on trying to remove the statue. And it was actually related to those issues that you brought City Council member Bob Fenwick around and got to the 3 out of 5 votes needed to remove the statue. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, simultaneously while working on trying to get the statue removed, I was also working on what's become known as the equity package, which is a nearly $4 million substantive policy measure within the budget with a variety of different budgetary implications, which included money for schools, money for parks, the creation of different entities within city staff to be able to address some of the disparities with African-American males and African-American youth as a whole and their counterparts, a litany of different things, job training programs, GED programs, and again, money also for the African-American Heritage Center, Jefferson School African-American Heritage Center. So, yeah, we had a policy measure with, again, several different budgetary implications that we, to the likes of which we haven't seen in Charlottesville before, and we were able to get that passed. I think Mr. Fenwick, while I think deep down he didn't want the statue to be there, he was also very concerned about what substantive measures we can take in addition to the symbolic. And once he was able to see that we would get those budgetary measures through, then he was confident in saying that he would be willing to vote with us to remove the statue.
Yeah. I also think a lot of people will probably be surprised in reading your book, I mean, among many other things, by or may not have known that you actually, when you were campaigning the first time for city council, held a campaign event in what was called Lee Park and then got some pushback about that. Can you describe what happened?
Sure. So, I mean, that was actually my first introduction to the history of what was then Lee Park as well as the statue. It was 2013. When I first ran for council, I was 24 years old. And, you know, just a young man thinking that, hey, let's have cookouts before it's the day, 2 days before the election. I had campaign cookouts throughout. And I said, hey, let's do one here at the park. It's close to downtown. We'll be able to tap into that population. He hadn't had one at that park. It was on a Saturday. And then I remember the following Sunday, the next day at church, there were a wide range of elders, African-American elders in our community, who very clearly stated to me that I didn't realize what I had done. And I didn't understand the history behind the statue as well as the park. And it was there in which they commenced to school me, or as my grandmother would say, they learned me about what truly had happened from their perspective in that park, about how people had had their faces slashed, people had been spat on, they were told never to step foot in the park, how they despised the statue that was there, how they vowed to never go down there. And they just told me how foolish I was to actually have a campaign cookout there, and it truly showed that I didn't understand the community. So that was my introduction to understanding that there are a lot of people, they may not be super vocal or be in positions in which they're very loud about why they don't like the park, but there are indeed a lot of people who do not go to what was then Lee Park because of the statue and what that park represents. And that was, again, my introduction to understanding that, hey, if the opportunity ever presented itself to be able to do something about it, then we need to think about it.
We're speaking with Dr. Wes Bellamy, who is a member of City Council here in Charlottesville, Virginia. Wes, I think a lot of people will also be surprised in reading your book at how you describe the events of August 12, 2017, as having been mostly white people on both sides, and how there was a big African-American event happening elsewhere in town simultaneously with lots of people just ignoring the whole thing that was national news.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that was very interesting, for lack of a better term, to me. So, I mean, even if you see a lot of the footage that was from downtown, on August 12th. The fact of the matter remains is that it's a lot of our white, in my opinion, our white allies fighting against the white supremacists and standing up and using their privilege and sacrificing their bodies, using their voice to speak up and speak out against the hate. And, I mean, simultaneously, at Tonsla Park, there were about 200, maybe 250 black children, and then maybe another 100 or 150 or so adults doing a back-to-school bash and a giveaway with a DJ and food. And, I mean, it was very well protected and secured by different brothers from the community at the top of the park. But, I mean, they were, again, making sure that they were going to take care of the community. There's a group of young brothers and sisters who put the event together. But, I mean, they were completely removed from what was transpiring downtown, and they were completely focused on the back-to-school bash. And talking to many people, I mean, it was kind of this thing where in which they felt like this isn't necessarily our fight. These things have been going on in Charlottesville and our community forever. This was really more so eye-opening and awakening for a lot of white people who lived in our area, because they didn't, or they may have been in denial that these things were still taking place. So, you know, the juxtapose and just the dichotomy of it all was very interesting. And I think it's a moment in history that we won't forget for a variety of reasons.
I think your book, it may also be eye-opening for some people about the performance of our then mayor, Mike Signer, who, if people saw the events in Charlottesville on TV, might have thought that taking down the statue was his idea. That wasn't quite the way it actually played out, was it?
No, and I didn't know that people thought that, but
well, that's the impression I think people might have gotten if I haven't done a national survey. But from watching the TV coverage that day and the next day, yeah, and the way he was talking, oh, okay, as the leader of the, gotcha, resistance, you would think, oh, okay, you would think that it was his idea to begin with. But it wasn't, was it?
Yeah, no, you know, Mr. Signer, and Mike, and I just also want to be clear that, you know, I'm not sure how it came off in the book. I'll be honest, I haven't read the book. I did read the book. I had to record the audio book, which will be coming out next week, and it's in my voice. So I read the book the one time when, you know, we're doing the recordings of the audio book.
Sure.
This book really came out because it was more so therapy for me. My therapist had suggested that I write about my feelings and what was going on and kind of get it off of my chest. So when I was writing it and kind of I had some friends look over it, and they said, hey, maybe you should turn this into a book. And then we went to the editor and publisher and whatnot, and they, you know, cleaned it up and whatnot. So I will say in its entirety, I haven't read the book, although a lot of people have been saying to me they read it, they like it, they're learning a lot. So, you know, Mike, I don't want it to seem as if, like, Mike and I hate each other. I don't have any
No, I didn't think
will.
That.
Oh, okay, good. So, yeah, but Mike, I think Mike, his position in regards to the statue, he really had a position in which he wanted to figure out how to address the issue with the least amount of resistance as possible in regards to, like, he didn't want to create, he just didn't want to be forced into doing something that I don't think he wanted to do. And that's just my opinion. Mike's a very cerebral, very analytical guy. He can be sometimes risk averse, as most attorneys are by training. And he didn't really want to jump into it, I think, the same way that I wanted to. And that's also okay. And, you know, we just had different opinions about it. And I think, as you see in the book, as things continue to transpire, he took his position and I took mine, and it is what it is. He didn't really want the statue moved. Even after August 12th, he was kind of like, I still don't want it moved. But I think he came around after the funeral of Heather Heyer, and that's when he first came to me and said, yeah, I'll vote. I would like to vote again to have the statue removed. But you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. To be clear for people outside of Charlottesville who may not know, the Lee statue and the Jackson statue have never yet been moved and are still there. Can you explain why they're still there?
Yeah, so we're currently in a legal battle about whether or not we'll be able to remove the statues. We actually go to court next week to hear on the matter and whatnot, and we'll be hearing whether or not our local judge believes that we will be able to move the statutes by law. We've been arguing, and I think, in my opinion, it's rather clear that those statues were not are not war memorials. Paul McIntyre, when he created the or when he made the Lee statue, he wrote very clearly in the deed. He didn't say anything about the Confederacy, nothing about the soldiers, the generals, any of that. He just said these are statues dedicated to my parents, and I want these statues to be in the middle of the city. Basically to send a message to the community, but also in memory of my parents. So to me, it's rather clear it's not a war memorial. However, we'll see what the judge says. I think whether or not he rules in our favor or not, the decision will more than likely be appealed one way or another. Then I have to go to the state Supreme Court. So this will be a long battle that we're in for some time, and we'll see what happens.
It's an interesting and new argument to me that they're not war memorials, and people should be aware that the law prevents removing war memorials, not racist monuments, as if you could have a non-racist war memorial. But they are war figures in their uniforms, on their horses, with their swords. I mean, they look exactly like any other war memorial to me.
I mean, I understand that. I understand why some will say that. But I think, again, the fact remains that McIntyre was rather clear. He's dedicated to my family.
Yeah.
And the attorney general has also, wrote an opinion in which he stated that he believes that the law that is currently constructed does not apply to these kind of memorials. And, in fact, that was more or less the motivation behind getting started. Governor McCullough vetoed a bill that was trying to retroactively lump these memorials into the current law, and he said no, he doesn't believe that should be the case. And then we subsequently said, okay, well, let's pursue this.
So I think it's important that you note that the state's attorney general has said that the law doesn't apply retroactively to before the law was created, banning the removal of war memorials, and therefore Charlottesville can remove it or move to other places. It's war memorials. I guess that's not sufficient to go ahead and act on, though.
It's a very interesting piece. I'm not the attorney, and I'm not the one representing the city. So, we'll see how it plays out next week in court and then the subsequent actions that transpire after.
Okay. The other question that I've always had in mind about this this disaster of August 12th, 2017, is that this group of people, as you note in your book, had already engaged in violence in other cities around the country and were rather openly threatening violence, and then engaged in violence the night before at the University of Virginia down the street.
Right.
Why was there no ability for anyone to act even at that point and say, This event is canceled the next day when people are armed and engaging in violence the night before and threatening violence for the following day? That's sufficient. This is canceled. Why was that not possible?
Well, the federal, as we talk about in the book, I was actually amazed that the federal judge, represented by the ACLU, Kessler rather, was represented by the ACLU. The federal judge stated that the event had to go on. It's a free speech matter, and even with the history of violence and the threat of public safety, they still believe that we should be able, or excuse me, that Kessler should and the United Right should still be able to have their rally, and for nothing else. That's why it took place in what was then Lee Park, for no other reason than that. Emancipation Park. That's why it took place. We tried to not necessarily stop the rally, but move it to McIntyre. The judge said no, and that's what we had to abide by.
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that even the ACLU has more recently said that they will at least rethink their point of view. But isn't it rather insane to suppose that an armed event threatening violence is a question of free speech? I mean, that seems as crazy to me as, you know, bribing politicians is free speech.
Mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling. And I was very sad that actually took place. But, hey, that's what happened, and we saw the end result.
Yeah. Now, the one-year anniversary, not much happened. Some people were afraid that something would happen. The whole city looked like a military camp again. But I was interested in the fact that on the one-year anniversary, the city banned every kind of weapon under the sun except guns. And we could talk about that absurdity. But why wasn't that done a year before? Why weren't torches and sticks and knives and every sort of weapon other than guns banned a year before?
Yeah, well, I think that there are a lot of things that we could go back in 2017 and say that we should have done differently. Personally, I don't want to get into the tactical plans as of why this didn't happen and why that didn't happen. I wasn't directly involved in the tactical plans. And with that being said, hindsight is always 2020.
Yeah.
I'm glad that we got it right in 2018. I wish that some things would have been different in 2017. But again, you know, everyone can say that X, Y, and Z should have been done differently. And I think I allude to that a little bit in the book. But, you know, when I think about that day, there are a lot of things that could have been done differently. And I think that's probably best for me to say.
Yeah. Do you share my belief that it's wrong for the state government to prevent localities from banning guns from events?
Oh, so I've been to the state house and testified in committee meetings about why I believe that guns should be banned, not only from these kind of rallies, but also just from like public meetings, such as city council meetings and in city halls and places like that. But they have been vehement in terms of denying those bills and not even letting them get out of committee on a very party-lined vote. So what's very interesting is that Republicans oftentimes stack these subcommittees where they know these bills about prohibiting gun use or prohibiting guns in certain buildings, venues, events. And the Republicans literally just vote and they come up with all these different excuses and say, no, we need to be able to have the guns there. Even after Heather Heyer was killed, we saw what transpired in Charlottesville with someone being shot at and all these individuals with AR-15s and these different guns and so forth. I still believe that the weapons should be there. So the only thing I could tell people to do is to get engaged, to vote, and to actually come down to the General Assembly when these bills are being presented, and exercise your right to vote.
Yeah, do you think that Charlottesville will ever put up a monument to peace or education or civil rights or women's rights or labor or environment or anything other than wars? do we have any monuments that aren't for a war?
Yeah, well, the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center is working on a sculpture / memorial now. And I know the city, we have some plans to do some other things. I'm not at liberty to say at the moment, but rest assured, we have intentions of telling the full story.
I would love to see some kind of a monument or memorial to Charlottesville's sister cities and or some kind of a monument to peace. I mean, you guys on city council vote against wars, vote to tell Congress to move the money to human needs and not to the military. But the whole city is full of war monuments and there's not one to peace. Do you think we could ever get one to peace?
I hope so. And I think that, you know, again, let's continue to push and be vocal about the need for it.
Yeah. What do you think about President, I hate to say that, Donald Trump's conduct before and after this event? I mean, I think this is one of many impeachable offenses as well as possible criminal charges, the instigation of hateful, racist
violence by a president-to-be and a president?
Well, I think that I think that 45 has been very intentional in terms of very methodical in regards to being able to embolden a population of people who he knows will be very radical in regards to expressing his views and the views in which he likes to represent. He's been very, very strategic in doing so. Him saying that there were bad people on both sides was absolutely just one of the most disrespectful things I've ever heard. When you think about people with guns and swords and shields literally coming there with intentions on harming and even killing someone as they did, and then another group of people saying that we're going to be here to try and protect those from being hurt, I don't know how you can make an equivalent to the two and say that they're good people on both sides. In any event, you know, if 45 wants to align himself with the David Dukes of the world, who said clearly that they came there to fulfill the hopes of their president,
right,
the promise of their president, then that's on him. I mean, his behavior is his behavior. It's not going to change. He is who he is.
We've got just about a minute left. Wes Spellme, I have to ask you, it's been in a little bit of the news lately, and I've got a petition going with hundreds of Charlottesville signatures asking Charlottesville to not invest its money in either weapons manufacturers or fossil fuel producers. What do you think are the possibilities of the city making that change to more ethical investments?
Yeah, I think it's something that I hope that we'll do. Let's continue to explore the topic. Let's continue to get more information. And, you know, I don't think it's a bad idea at all. I think it's basically an ethical thing to do, as you alluded to. So, you know, if we can make it happen, let's make it happen. I know it's a very complicated kind of situation on which there's a lot of different ways in which the city spends its money. So, you know, it requires a little bit more exploration. But I appreciate you and I applaud you for bringing this before us.
If we usually to get things done, we have to bring a big petition and a crowd of people to a meeting, and then something happens at the next meeting. Is that what you recommend to people?
I'm going to stay out of that one.
You're going to stay out of advising us.
I'm going to stay out of that one.
Okay. Well, we have been speaking with Dr. Wes Spellme. His book, which you can pick up now, is called Monumental. It was never about a statue. And I guess the audiobook is coming out as well very soon.
Yep, audiobook next week. You can get the book on Amazon. You can also check your local Barnes & Noble for the hardback copy. And we have book signings. The book tour kicks off right here in Charlottesville on Thursday, January 10th. And we'll be going to a variety of different cities around the country. So hope to see you there.
Is there a website or a Facebook or something for that?
Yeah, literally, you can check out WesSpellmeOfficial.com, and you'll see the list of all of the book tour dates. You can also get your copy of the book there as well. And, you know, again, thanks for all the support.
Wes Spellme, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
All right. Have a good one.
You too. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, counterspending.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, whether as a boondoggle, a cartoon, or a mindless chant in the two-minute hate, building a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border is an abstraction for many Americans, a political plot point. Among those for whom it is not that, people who live in the borderlands, and those who listen to those who do. We'll talk with reporter Debbie Weingarten about the walls that already exist on the southern border. Also on the show, speaking of cartoons, trying to get a sensible understanding of Venezuela from U.S. news media is like studying the Vietnam War by watching Rambo. We'll decipher coverage of the re-election of President Nicolas Maduro with Alexander Main, Director of International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. All of that's coming up, and we'll get straight to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Only the easily surprised can be surprised that, gifted by the networks with a primetime platform with which to explain what emergency at the U.S.-Mexico border necessitates the extended partial shutdown of the U.S. government, Donald Trump delivered familiar hate-mongering and falsehoods, all in service of his notion of a border wall, which, it's been recently reported, was intended as just a sort of mnemonic device advisors gave Trump as a candidate to remind him to talk tough on immigration. Fact-checking is fine as far as it goes, but were media to devote less attention to rhetoric and more to the reality of life as lived along the U.S. southern border, any conversation about walls could at least be grounded in an understanding of the barriers that already exist, with significant impacts on the community and the environment. Our next guest's recent work reflects those concerns. Reporter Debbie Weingarten is a fellow for Talk Poverty and for the Center for Community Change. She joins us now by phone from Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to Counterspin, Debbie Weingarten.
Thanks for having me.
Whether it's discussed as a dumb idea or a great idea, an expensive idea, the construction of a wall on the border of the U.S. and Mexico is generally discussed as an idea. In your recent piece for Talk Poverty, I also saw it on Truthout, you illustrate that the conversation really isn't about building a wall, but building another wall or more wall. Can you talk about the nature, physical and otherwise, of the already existing barriers at the U.S.-Mexico border?
Right. The U.S.-Mexico border spans about 2,000 miles. And of that, about 700 miles is covered in some sort of barrier. That looks different depending on where you are. In some areas, it's more of a fence, and in other places, it's an actual steel wall. I'll note that I live in Tucson, which is about 60 miles north of Nogales in the U.S.-Mexico border. And Nogales used to essentially be one town that stretched across both sides of the border. But after Operation Gatekeeper began in the early 90s, as part of the Clinton administration's plan to curb undocumented immigration, there was a huge rusty wall that went up and literally just sliced the town in half. So, I mean, the wall is, to give you a sense of what it looks like, I mean, it's made out of old, rusty Vietnam War landing strip. It is, in some places, 30 feet tall. So it changed the landscape dramatically.
And there are walls also in the sense of there are cameras and there is monitoring and there are other things that we might not think of as a wall, but they certainly are effective barriers to movement.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's one thing that I think is missing in the national conversation, just how militarized our communities, our border communities have become. Beyond just walls, we have drones and we have surveillance towers and border patrol checkpoints and underground sensors. It's more than just a wall.
Well, I wanted to pick up on some of the history that you just were noting. You pointed out in a piece back in the spring that when Trump is threatening to send troops to the border, that would not, in fact, be the first time that had happened. Here, as elsewhere, Trump's actions are brazen and may represent an escalation, but they aren't wholly original. And when it comes to border issues, we can point to a few key moments in policy that have shaped the situation that you're describing now. And one of those, as you just mentioned, was Operation Gatekeeper and this idea of prevention through deterrence. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the ongoing impacts of that policy.
Yeah, Operation Gatekeeper was, again, the Clinton administration's attempt to curb undocumented immigration. You know, that was essentially an attempt to seal urban areas along the border. And that accompanied a strategy by the Border Patrol called Prevention Through Deterrence, which essentially they were hoping that by sealing urban areas that migrants would be deterred from crossing the border. But what we know, and, you know, in our lived daily lives here on the borderlands, we know that that tactic just pushed border crossers further out into the desert. So, and again, hard to imagine maybe being someplace else, but this desert is beautiful, but it's rugged and it's inhospitable. In the summer, we have temperatures that can reach 120 degrees. And in the winter, it can dip below freezing at night. So, you know, and we have summer monsoon storms. So it's very, very rugged. And prevention through deterrence simply pushed people out into the desert, sometimes to their death. So at this point, over 7,000 bodies have been found in our desert, and thousands more are missing.
I would say I have heard you and others even allude to the idea of weaponizing the desert, and that would seem to be kind of what you're evoking with that expression.
Right. I think that the people who live in the borderlands feel that not only are there weapons, literal weapons, being carried by troops and Border Patrol agents along our border and in our borderlands, but that the desert itself has been used against border crossers. So, you know, they're counting on the cactus and the lack of water and the rocks that people twist their ankles on and the wildlife, the rattlesnakes, to keep people out.
Well, since the Operation Gatekeeper and this prevention through deterrence, we've also seen follow-up from subsequent administrations, things like the Real ID Act in 2005 and the Secure Fence Act. And I know that in addition to the human impact, and of course it's all related, but these have also had effects on the natural environment in border areas.
Right. So one of the provisions in the Real ID Act of 2005 was that it included a provision that gives the Secretary of Homeland Security the power to waive any federal or state law that they felt was at odds with, and I'm going to quote here, the expeditious construction of physical barriers and roads along the U.S.-Mexico border. So that meant that federal laws, really important federal laws, are essentially off the books in certain parts of the border. So, you know, really basic environmental protections like Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, really obvious and backbone environmental protections are no longer, you know, intact along the border, which means that border residents are living in communities with fewer environmental and human rights protections. And then again, I mean, consequences to the natural environment. The Sonoran Desert is, it's the most biologically diverse desert in the United States. It's home to all kinds of threatened species, including jaguars and Mexican gray wolves, ocelots. So the barrier, any barrier really, you know, has the potential to threaten habitat, food access, access to mates, seasonal migration, you know, what happens when you prevent species from moving. So I think that that is something really important to note. And it's a place where the environmental community, you know, the human rights community and indigenous communities have really come together against border militarization for these reasons.
And just to follow up on that, as I know you've also written about the particular impact on indigenous communities there who are especially affected by some of these environmental changes.
Right. The Tonopah tribe spans the U.S.-Mexico border, so they have members on both sides of the border. And, you know, up until Operation Gatekeeper, they could freely cross the border. They basically maintain that any barrier or border is, you know, against their way of life. And since Operation Gatekeeper and the increased militarization of the border, You know, they have Border Patrol agents all over their community. I spoke with one activist, April Ignacio, who is Autumn, and she told me all kinds of stories about tribal members who are pulled over by the Border Patrol while collecting basket weaving materials or harvesting saguaro fruit in the summertime or hunting for ceremony. So it has a huge impact on the tribal communities here.
So environmental rules being softened or even waived is one of the ways that the border is seen as and spoken of as a kind of zone of exception. And then the actions of the Border Patrol would seem to be another. I just want to ask you, what would you hope for people to understand about the day-to-day effects, the daily life impacts of border militarization and other forms of barrier building for people living where you live?
Well, I think the impact of this on our daily life is huge. Really specific examples include rural residents and farmers that have to stop at Border Patrol checkpoints just to go to the grocery store every time they leave their home. Again, Indigenous people having guns pulled on them while they're out hunting. There's a high degree of racial profiling. So people of color, again, Indigenous communities are most impacted. I always think about the ACLU, which refers to the border as a constitution-free zone, because the Border Patrol can essentially, you know, they can operate 100 miles from the border with extra constitutional powers beyond just normal law enforcement. So I think it's worth noting that the other thing that this does is that it leaves our communities to respond to a humanitarian crisis caused by inhumane policy at the federal level. So our community members are the ones, you know, putting water in the desert for migrants who are in distress and documenting Border Patrol abuses, supporting families who are getting released from detention in the middle of the night. So I think it's worth noting that most people who live near the border do not support a wall.
That's very significant. And I would hope just finally something for journalists to follow up on. Are there any things that you would like to see reporters doing more of or doing less of?
I mean, I would love to see more folks from these communities, reporters from these communities, being able to tell the stories of their own communities. You know, it's hard when journalists are flown in and try to get a lay of the land just in a day or two. I do think that there's this painting by the Trump administration that the borderlands are just violent and out of control. And there are lots of other things that we're worried about. We largely do not want a wall, and we largely do not want more militarization. I think that D.C. has been consistently out of touch with the reality of the borderlands, as we've seen by increased militarization. And I think that the anti-immigrant rhetoric of the Trump administration, you know, takes us to a whole new level and fuels hate speech and it fuels violence. So we on the borderlands do not want to be a pawn in that game.
We've been speaking with reporter Debbie Weingarten. You can find her article, We Already Have a Border Wall, It's an Environmental Disaster, online at talkpoverty.org. Debbie Weingarten, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
When it comes to Venezuela, elite U.S. media don't hide their feelings. And their feelings are all the same. Headlines on last year's re-election of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro differed only in tone, including the disdainful, "As Venezuelans go hungry, their government holds a farcical election," from The Economist, the decisive, USA Today's "Maduro is turning Venezuela into a dictatorship," or Foreign Affairs' more somber version, "Venezuela's suicide, lessons from a failed state." There's Forbes' vaguely threatening, "Why Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela may wish he lost the presidential election," and Foreign Policy's unashamed, "It's time for a coup in Venezuela." But they're all pretty much variations on a theme that's hard to unhear, given that media bang it out so loudly and repeatedly. Here to help us sort fact from froth is Alexander Main. He's Director of International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Alex Main.
Thank you, Janine.
Well, writing for FAIR on Venezuelan elections last year, Alan McLeod pinpointed U.S. media's preferred trope, which was to say that Maduro was reelected amid outcry, amid widespread disillusionment, amid charges of irregularities, amid low turnout. The message, I think, to readers was that Maduro's reelection was not legitimate. What should we know about last May's elections in Venezuela?
Well, so what isn't generally mentioned by the media is that a critical factor in the outcome of the election was the approach taken by Venezuela's opposition. Much of the opposition, many of its parties, decided to boycott these elections for a variety of reasons. At any rate, the media did not examine that fact, and we're still not seeing it very much. I think one of the few exceptions is the Washington Post in the article that appeared today that did mention the divisions within the opposition and their decision not to participate that had obviously a huge effect on the election result.
The media coverage would give you the impression that it's Venezuela's election almost happened in a vacuum, but there was, in fact, involvement from, for example, the Organization for American States.
Well, the Organization of American States, or rather Secretary General of the organization, whose name is Luis Almagro, he represents himself. He was elected, but once Secretary General, he sort of has executive power there, but he doesn't represent the countries within the organization. He has been on a campaign against the Maduro government from very early on. It stems from their initial decision not to allow him to send electoral observers to the elections. And this is based on decision taken by Venezuela's electoral authorities many years ago when they decided that they had enough transparency, enough safety measures around the elections that they no longer required any sort of outside tutelage. A number of countries in Latin America have taken the same decision, and it's a decision that has to do with the respect of their sovereignty. And certainly you don't see in the U.S. any massive presence of international observers, even though I think a lot of people would like to see that at some point. But anyway, this was a sovereign decision that was taken by Venezuela's electoral authority. And following that, Almagro really went on a rampage and has been very much involved in efforts to try to delegitimize the Maduro government and to support the very hardline opposition. In doing this, went sort of out of bounds in terms of his rhetoric, even for a lot of right-wing governments in Latin America, when late last year he voiced support for a military coup, much as some U.S. officials have done and U.S. members of Congress have done. And as a response, you had all of the governments of Latin America that signed on to a statement that categorically rejected the possibility of any sort of form of military intervention, whether by coup or an outside military intervention in Venezuela. But certainly his rhetoric and the campaign that he has led along with other figures such as Senator Marco Rubio have certainly given the impression that there is a desire for U.S. intervention in what's going on in Venezuela. And that's, I think, resulted in sort of a defensive reaction from the Venezuelan government.
Well, it sounds very disturbing, but also confusing. You know, when I was looking through headlines, I saw one from something called the Pacific Council on International Policy that said, Maduro reelected. Can democracy ever prevail in Venezuela? I mean, and just at the level of the sentence, it's confusing. And then when you start talking about a coup to save democracy, which is the upshot of current coverage and I guess policy, it just doesn't even seem to make sense. The call is for the U.S. to intervene, but the U.S. is already intervening, aren't they?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And they've really been intervening in Venezuela, you know, various U.S. administrations since at least the early 2000s, when we know that the U.S. government, through institutions like the National Endowment for Democracy, have been providing funding and training to opposition groups in Venezuela and often very hardline groups that have taken a radical line you know, not recognizing the government and trying to seek its removal through extra constitutional means, including a short-lived coup that took place in April of 2002. The U.S. has been very involved in trying to isolate Venezuela diplomatically throughout the region, putting a lot of pressure on Latin American governments to support U.S. measures condemning the situation in Venezuela. You know, more recently, the U.S. has been applying sanctions against the government of Venezuela. And this is a very underreported thing in the U.S. media and the international media generally. When you see the coverage, for instance, of the Maduro inauguration, what you don't see at all are references to the impact of the economic sanctions that have been applied. In fact, there are few media outlets at this point that even acknowledge that there are economic sanctions, even though they've been in place since August of 2017, you know, when Trump announced them through an executive decree, having determined Venezuela to be an extraordinary threat to U.S. national security. Those were the actual terms that were used in order to justify these sanctions. And they've had a dire effect in Venezuela, which has been experiencing an economic crisis for quite a while now, since 2014 at least. And the government, of course, has failed to resolve this. It has to do with some of the government's own economic policies. But at this point, the U.S. also bears responsibility through these sanctions, where they have cut off Venezuela's access to international financial markets by which they can borrow money and purchase the necessary imports that the country needs. And we know that there aren't enough imports of food or of medicine that are taking place at the moment. And it's also had a dire effect on the country's oil production. And of course, oil is the source of most of Venezuela's national revenue. Along with falling oil prices, there's been a tremendous fall in oil production in Venezuela. And it accelerated, actually, after these sanctions were put into place, because the Venezuelan government isn't able to make the necessary investments to maintain the oil fields. So that's not mentioned really whatsoever in the major media, even though you have economists, including opposition-aligned economists from Venezuela, like Francisco Rodriguez, who have pointed out the very negative impact that these sanctions are having on the country.
Alan McLeod also found a piece in Bloomberg that came close to acknowledging it, but in such a strange way. It was an article in which Bloomberg said that victory in the widely derided election gives Maduro sole ownership of the nation's crushing economic crisis. And then in the very next sentence, it sort of gloats that U.S. and regional leaders will punish Venezuela by imposing further isolation and sanctions on the crisis-stricken nation's all-important oil industry.
Exactly. There's this absurd idea that the sanctions somehow only hurt the Venezuelan government and Venezuelan government officials. It's always the Venezuelan government's responsibility when they discuss the economic situation. From time to time, you do see some media saying, oh, but the Venezuelan government says that the U.S. sanctions are contributing to, you know, this dire economic situation. They fail to ask any independent expert, you know, any economist that are taking a good look at what's going on in Venezuela today will tell you, well, yes, these sanctions quite obviously are having a very negative impact.
Finally, one of the things that coverage does is present the Venezuelan people as, you know, benighted. A piece from Reuters from last year includes one of my favorite creations. It first of all says that the crisis, the current crisis, can be traced to the 1998 election of Hugo Chavez to the presidency. You know, so Chavez is the reason that things are difficult now. But I love this presentation. Quote, Chavez concocted a political system that used often high oil prices to essentially bribe the masses into supporting him. Close quote. The picture of the Venezuelan people that one gets from U.S. media coverage is really as sort of benighted and not knowing what's good for themselves and once again requiring some sort of intervention to tell them how to do democracy.
Yes, this is quite absurd. Really, what we're seeing in Venezuela is, one, an extraordinarily well-organized population, and particularly in poor communities that are certainly confronting a very dramatic economic situation, but I think doing so in effective ways that, you know, make the situation somewhat sustainable for these communities. So we're seeing a very, very high level of community organization. I'd say the vast majority of Venezuelans at this point are probably quite disgruntled with Maduro and his government. However, the Venezuelan opposition really offers no sort of viable alternative to the Maduro government. They have never presented any sort of coherent economic proposal, with the possible exception of the opposition candidate in last year's election. But of course, most of the opposition parties boycotted those elections. And in general, I think a lot of Venezuelans, certainly those that come from lower income communities, are well aware of the fact that the opposition is linked to the country's traditional economic elite. And they have a terrible reputation from their involvement in governments before Chavez was in power. Things may be bad under Maduro, but I think there's a sense among many Venezuelans that things could actually be quite a bit worse under opposition governments, particularly if they impose the sort of neoliberal policies that hurt the poor people of Venezuela enormously during the decades prior to Hugo Chavez's election in the late 90s.
We've been speaking with Alexander Main. He's Director of International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can find their work, including Alex's piece, The United States' Hand in Undermining Democracy in Venezuela, online at CEPR.net. That's CEPR.net. Alexander Main, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York, online at fair.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up, the venerable Noam Chomsky on our climate crisis, and Nicholas Reese on the startling impacts of air pollution on babies and toddler brain development. But first, we must prevent mass climate suicide by coal. Do you think coal power is disappearing, being replaced by cleaner natural gas and renewable energy? Think again. According to data released by the International Energy Agency in 2018, coal consumption is going back up after 2 years of decline. That is terrible news for our future climate. Most of that new demand is coming from Asia. Japan and South Korea are pumping billions into new coal plant construction. Despite the good news you've heard about massive renewables in China, Chinese banks are investing tens of billions of dollars to expand coal power in many places in the world. Here to give us the big picture is Heffa Schücking. Heffa is a long-standing environmental leader in Germany and a winner of the Goldman Environmental Prize. She is managing director of the German nonprofit group Urgewald, which maintains a database of all coal projects and investors worldwide. Heffa Schücking, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
So what does your group Urgewald's name mean in English?
Well, it's not really translatable in German. It's a word play between the two words for primary forest and primary force, like nature's force. And it works very well in German because people look at it and think, this is misspelled somehow. So they remember our name, but it's not really a good name for international purposes.
All right. Well, we want to talk about the drive to expand coal power by China and others, but let us start with your own country. From outside, we hear a lot about solar power and Danish wind sweeping into the German electricity system, but at least 35% of German power still comes from coal. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, for 2018, renewables made up 37% of Germany's electricity mix, and coal power was also at 37%.
And I read that in October 2018, about 50,000 protesters, that's quite a few people, showed up to fight off the energy company RWE. That company wants to clear-cut more ancient forest for a giant open-pit coal mine. Please tell us what is going on there.
The Hambach Forest, it's about an eighth of the forest is still left. Most of it has already been destroyed for a huge open-pit lignite mine run by RWE. The forest is about 12,000 years old. It has over 100 bird species and 10 bat species, some of them very rare species. And at a time in Germany where actually the German government has set up a commission that is debating, negotiating a coal phase-out for Germany, it seems completely crazy to destroy such a valuable and unique piece of nature when it's quite clear that Germany has to move out of coal-fired power production completely. Yeah, if you look at the situation in Europe, then 53% of Europe's emissions are due to the German and the Polish coal industry. Like, Europe's whole ability to meet its climate goals under the Paris Climate Agreement really depends on a German coal phase-out.
And to prevent horrible climate change, we know we need to get out of coal power, as you say. But according to the group Coal Exit, since the Paris Climate Agreement of 2015, the number of coal power plants in the world has continued to grow. They say new coal plants, starting up in just the last 3 years, use as much coal as, quote, all of Japan's and Russia's coal plants put together. That's an incredible number. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I do have to say the number has to be put in perspective. Like, if we were looking at the pipeline of new coal plants, 2 years ago, this pipeline was over 1,200,000 megawatts. The first time when we did this research, I mean, we were really, really frightened. Last year, that pipeline of new coal projects had gone down to 840,000 megawatts. And now the pipeline is at 670,000 megawatts. that's still not tenable. I mean, it means if all of those coal plants were built, 670,000 that have currently been announced or in some stage of planning, it would still mean that we would increase the world's coal plant fleet by 33%. But it's a little bit sort of the glass is half full, the glass is half empty situation. Actually, many, many coal plants have been scrapped over the past 2 years, but there's still just way too many out there that are either under development, have been announced, and are threatening to be built and that have to be stopped. Otherwise, we have no chance of achieving the Paris climate goal.
No country has installed more solar power or more mass transit than China. They are world leaders in alternative tech in some ways. But what is the situation with coal power in China now?
Well, China, it's really the elephant in the room, both when it comes to coal power generally, but also if we look at sort of the pipeline of new projects. I mean, China has plans for 259,000 megawatts of new coal plants. It's about a third of the coal plants that are in the pipeline globally. At the same time, the Chinese government at some point a few years ago, they announced a cap on installed coal power capacity of the country. This cap was set at something like 1,100,000 megawatts, and China is now at around 990,000 installed megawatts. That means if the pipeline of new Chinese coal plants get built, China is going to fail, basically. The stated goal of the Chinese government. There are huge conflicts in China around this question, especially in connection with the massive pollution caused by the Chinese coal industry. I mean, every year in China, over 360,000 people die prematurely due to just pollution from the coal industry. And, you know, those pollution deaths, the air pollution is something that nobody can get away from. Even the members of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party and their families are affected by this. And while there's a growing realization in China that somehow a further development of the coal industry needs to be stopped, at the same time, there's huge pressure from the provinces and from the companies in China who have been building new coal plants. And it's a difficult situation, but a lot depends. I mean, the future of our climate really depends on coming to terms with this.
Well, I think one of the ways that the United States managed to lower their emissions somewhat was by exporting some of their dirtiest industries offshore to Asia, to China in particular, things like steel production. And now I'm wondering if, due to these hundreds of thousands of deaths that you've talked about, maybe China will try to export some of the dirtiest coal production to other countries and have their production come from there instead. Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, we also see that happening. I mean, we see that the Chinese coal plant manufacturers who used to get all of their new contracts from within country, that they're now looking abroad for new contracts, and they're being supported in this venture by the Chinese government and by the Chinese banking system. And about one-sixth of Chinese-led coal plant development is actually taking place outside of China now.
Right. A Radio EcoShock listener wrote to complain to me about Chinese banks putting up money for another coal power plant in Serbia. So does your database keep track of things like that?
Yeah, exactly. In Serbia, 75% of Serbia's electricity production, it's coal-fired, mainly by lignite. And in spite of the fact that Serbia is already violating European pollution laws due to the heavy pollution load of those coal plants, there is a plan to build two further coal plants in Serbia, and This is basically a partnership between Serbia's national utility company called EPS and the China Machinery Engineering Corporation. And Chinese banks have offered to pay for the construction of the new coal plants.
In May 2017, the Global Environmental Institute, which is based in Beijing, reported that Chinese companies and banks are involved in 240 coal-fired power projects in 25 out of the 65 countries along their Belt and Road project. 54 were already under construction by 2016. First of all, Heffa, what is the Belt and Road project, briefly?
Well, it's an initiative announced by the Chinese Prime Minister Xi in 2013, and it's basically a kind of huge economic development project, but also a political strategic project of the Chinese government. And it's about developing new infrastructure, new economic zones, new transport projects in 65 countries around the world. So while it initially started mainly basically focused on Asia and Europe and Africa, I mean, the Belt and Road Project has now even been taken up with the goal of furthering Chinese influence in Latin America. So it's a huge political program. And what we see is that this program makes it much easier, for example, for Chinese coal plant developers to go and try and bring coal power to many African countries, for example, that do not have any installed coal-fired capacity as of yet.
A new continent to conquer for the coal power industry, and that's a pretty frightening idea. So what is the situation with coal power in India?
Well, India is also a country with the world's second largest coal plant pipeline. Over 100,000 megawatts of new coal plants are still being planned. At the same time, if we would have looked back a year ago, the pipeline would have been even much bigger. Over the past year, 24,000 megawatts of planned new coal capacity were scrapped in India. And this is mainly due to an enormous progression in renewable energy in the country. The price for renewable energy in India fell by something like 50% over the past 2 years. And that means that now building new wind and solar projects is actually 20% cheaper than even using existing coal-fired power generation.
Is there coal expansion in another country that you would like to tell us about, Heffa?
Well, for me, one of the really interesting cases is Egypt, which has the world's ninth largest coal plant pipeline. Now, if you would look back a few years ago, Egypt actually had a law against coal mining, coal power production, and even coal imports right up until 2015. This law was then scrapped under the El-Sisi regime, and what happened was that coal plant manufacturers from all over the world began flocking to Egypt to tell the Egyptian government, look, you need to build new coal plants. And so now you have a country that has not had a coal industry up to now, planning to build over 12,000 megawatts of new coal-fired power plants. I mean, this is a kind of development that's really, really frightening. As I'm myself from Germany, I see how hard it is once you have an entrenched coal industry, how hard it is to phase it out. And it seems completely crazy that a country like Egypt, which has an immense potential for renewable energy, would, you know, basically instead of leapfrogging to renewable energy systems, would go to the trouble of building up a coal industry now, especially if you take into consideration the fact that Egypt does not have coal reserves of its own and is going to have to import that coal anyway. That's a crazy situation, but it's driven very much by companies from abroad. And in Egypt, for example, this is two Chinese companies, Shanghai Electric and Dongfeng Electric, which together with an Egyptian construction company will build the world's largest coal-fired power station with 6,000 megawatts.
In Egypt?
In Egypt, yeah.
The world's biggest. We're going the wrong direction.
Yeah, we're going in the wrong direction in many countries. And, I mean, we've talked a lot about China, and people are aware of China as sort of a huge problem when it comes to, you know, the expansion of coal-fired capacity. But actually, if I look at the U.S., I mean, in a lot of these projects in African countries, I run across General Electric. You have General Electric right now who also wants to sell their equipment for coal-fired power plants, lobbying in South Africa to get the South African government, which actually already has a lot, way too much installed coal capacity, to build yet another coal-fired power station. I mean, this is one of the reasons why at Urgewald we decided it was really important to put this information out there for the finance industry to know which companies are planning to build new coal-fired power stations, because these companies are really clearly at odds with the Paris Climate Agreement and are basically working towards catastrophic climate change.
Let's make a buck by wrecking the climate. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Heffa Schucking, director of the German nonprofit group Urgewald, and they report that new coal plants are planned in many countries, promising a continuing disaster for our climate. So, Heffa, in your list of the world's top 10 developers of coal power by megawatts planned, 7 of the top 10 are Chinese companies or government-owned banks. Can people and groups outside of China have any hope of changing that?
Well, definitely, because, I mean, number one, I think it's important to say China is one-third of the world's coal plant pipeline, but two-thirds are outside of China. That's one thing to remember. The other thing is that if we look at sort of who is financing and who is investing in the top coal plant developers, then we see a pattern where Japanese and European banks, for example, are very important when it comes to direct lending to these companies. Chinese banks are very important when it comes to underwriting new bond and share issues. But when we look at who are the institutional investors who are buying the shares and bonds of these companies, actually the U.S. is the country that comes up the most. I mean, around 35% of institutional investments in coal plant developers are by U.S. institutions such as BlackRock or T. Rowe Price or Vanguard.
I note that 5 major coal companies in the United States, big corporations, have gone bankrupt in the last 3 years, yet they reorganize and mostly keep operating. It seems like it's such a high-risk industry. It still finds investors. It sounds like a bit of a Ponzi scheme. You sell all this coal power, but then you know that in the future, because people are suffering from climate change, they will cancel this industry. How does it manage to keep going?
I think the U.S. situation is a special one because basically somehow in the U.S. when companies go bankrupt, they're still allowed to keep on operating. This is different in other parts of the world, and I can't really explain to you why that is. I do not understand how companies like Peabody Energy or Arch Coal, how they can keep on operating.
So eventually, I suppose coal operators may be sued for climate damage or even human rights abuse when countries disappear. Has Urgewald tried putting pressure on insurance companies to stop covering coal plants in their construction?
Yeah, we have, together also with other with NGO partners from other European countries, and I think this has been fairly successful. I mean, the insurance companies are, as a group, I would say, much more aware of the fact that climate change is already a reality and is impacting the economy of in many different places in the world, and also directly impacting their own portfolios. And in Europe, the 3 largest insurance companies, which are also 3 of the world's largest insurance companies, Allianz, AXA, and Generali, they have all adopted policies where they ban investments in companies that are still planning to build new coal power stations, and where they have announced that they will not directly insure the construction or development of new coal power stations or coal mines.
So how can we fight to keep our pension funds and tax dollars out of climate-wrecking coal projects?
Well, I think that financial institutions, I mean, this is all relatively new, the moves by the large European insurance companies. These are things that happened in 2017 and 2018. And I think it's something that needs to be replicated in other parts of the world, such as the U.S. or Japan, where still major finances are going to the development of to companies that are developing new coal power stations. I think what we really need to see is more attention by U.S. civil society, for example, on the role of the U.S. finance industry when it comes to the global coal industry. I mean, often when I talk to environment organizations from the U.S., they're saying, but look, U.S., the coal sector in the U.S. is not doing very well. And, you know, even under the President Trump, more coal power stations are being closed simply for economic reasons. But they seem to have forgotten that actually U.S. financial institutions still play a huge role in development of coal power in other countries, because the U.S., I mean, has the largest capital markets in the world and has the largest investors in the world. So I think that that's, you know, next to solving the problem of China's government actually managing to rein in China's coal power plants at home, there's the challenge of getting the U.S. finance industry and the Japanese finance industry to rein in their financial institutions who are investing in projects that at the end of the day are going to endanger us all.
Sure. I mean, if banks were investing in heroin production directly and openly, we'd all be very upset. But here we have an industry that even in China is killing, you know, almost 500,000 people a year with their pollution. And that works in parts of Europe and parts of other countries where people are dying from this. So if we don't manage to rein in these coal plants, do you think the very worst will happen to our climate?
I don't know how the fight will go. I mean, all of the coal plants that have been announced, there's enormous opposition. There's enormous opposition in Egypt, in Kenya, in Bangladesh, in the Philippines, in Myanmar, even in China, against building new coal plants because they're polluting. They use up lots of water. Coal mining is incredibly destructive. And people realize that this is a really cost-heavy form of energy production and that there are alternatives there. So, I mean, if I look at what has happened in Myanmar, for example, also an autocratic country where it's dangerous for people to protest, but a few years ago, I mean, there were plans to build something like 5,400 megawatts of new coal plants, and there were so many local protests that 3/4 of those projects had to be scrapped. So the pipeline is now at something like, I think, 1,200 or 1,400 megawatts. And we see that happening a lot. We see the price of renewables in some places, like India, falling so rapidly that all of a sudden it just becomes completely uneconomic to build new coal plants. Like the coal plant pipeline, those 670,000 megawatts that are in there, they're not all going to be built because there's a lot of resistance. But the thing is, local resistance isn't enough. We need to change the finance industry if we want to save the climate, because it's really, you know, in 20 years, we won't have to worry about new coal-fired power stations, or even in 15 years, because the economics will be different. It's really the next 10 to 15 years that if financing goes into those projects, if projects are already, if they're ready to go online, if that money has been spent, then the danger is that they will go online. It becomes much harder to stop this development from happening. So right now, I'm not, you know, I'm trying not to think of the worst case scenario. I'm thinking, yes, we need to move forward much more quickly with the finance industry. And what I find really interesting in Europe, for example, is that Allianz, they're the world's largest insurance company, and they came out and not only said, well, we won't invest anymore in coal plant developers, they also said, we are going to completely exit all forms of coal investment and coal insurance by 2040. And we're going to do this systematically, and now we're stopping business with any company that has over 30% of their electricity production or their revenues are coal-based. We're going to take that down to 25%, and by the time in a few years, and then we're going to go down to 20, and by 2040, 0% coal business. So they've announced a full coal exit. There are a few other examples now of financial institutions who have sort of followed and done the same thing. There's the largest private asset manager in Norway, for example, Storebrand. They've said they want to completely exit coal investments by 2026 already. People need to start asking their banks and their asset managers and their pension funds, what's your date for a coal exit?
And what is the Global Coal Exit List and how can we use it?
Well, the Global Coal Exit List, it tries to really make the coal industry as a whole visible to the finance industry. Because, you know, in many cases, you know, people always talk about the coal industry and they kind of think it's, you know, very clear who belongs to it. But it's not always that simple, you know. I mean, when we were doing this research and, you know, basically putting together a list of all of the companies worldwide that operate along the thermal coal value chain, I mean, we run across companies with names like China Africa Sunlight Energy, which is actually a company that wants to build a coal-fired power station in Zimbabwe, or a company called Silver Unicorn Trading, that actually is a coal trader. I mean, it's not always obvious. And the Global Coal Exit List, it makes those companies visible. It provides basic information on the companies. It tells you exactly which companies are planning to either build new coal power stations or develop new coal mines. And our hope is that, I mean, we're already seeing that many financial institutions just who have contacted us or asking us for a full version of that database. We have a version on the net that everybody can download, that NGOs can also use or citizens can use, students can use if they want to take a look at the endowment of their university, whether it's invested in bad coal companies, and then you need to know who the coal companies are, and that's where the Global Coal Exit List comes in.
Right, and that's at coalexit.org. As we wrap up, I notice you and Urge Valdeman campaigning on all kinds of environmental issues, from climate to forest to nuclear safety. After so much activism for over 25 years, Heffa Schuking, what keeps you going?
Well, I'm always struck by the fact how a small group of people can often achieve really big things. I mean, if I think about it, Allianz is the world's largest insurance company. And when we began talking to them in 2013, they said there's no way we're going to exclude the coal industry from our portfolio. And 5-6 years down the line, they've become a leader in terms of announcing a coal exit and excluding most of the coal industry from their investment portfolio and a commitment to fully exclude by 2040. And considering, I mean, Orgeval, we're not a huge organization. We have around 15 staff. That's the kind of stuff that keeps me going, that I see that the work we're doing, it makes a real difference in the world.
We have been talking with the well-known German environmentalist Heffa Schuking. She is director of the German nonprofit group Urgewald. I will put links to their site in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. For English language information about coal financing and expansion, you can check out coalswarm.org, coalswarm.org, and coalexit.org. Thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Next up, Noam Chomsky on the climate crisis.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
No one's going to be brought to the Hague, but recognizing that it would be legitimate and justified is an important way of helping people comprehend the enormity of what is happening before their eyes.
First, I want to thank you for coming. We do these scientists warning.tv programs every day at the COP at 3 o'clock. I've been doing this for several years. My name's Stuart Scott. I'm the host for these simulated TV talk shows and coming to you live from COP24. And I'm the executive director of scientistswarning.org. So today's guest, yes, Noam Chomsky. He's professor emeritus of MIT. He's a current laureate professor at the University of Arizona. He's said to be one of the most cited scholars in history. And I believe he's the conscience of America, which right now is displaying a particular lack of conscience. And the name we're calling this program is Political Betrayal Turning into Mobilizing Action. And I want to offer a belated birthday greeting to Noam, who turned 90 on December 7th. I turned 70 on December 7th. We share a birthday. But he's got 20 years of wisdom and experience on me. And as I said, these are the answers that he gave to questions that I posed to him, and I'll read the questions to you. How do you view humanity's present situation in terms of the climate crisis and our attempts to deal with it at the UN climate negotiations?
Well, we face a very serious dilemma, stark, cruel dilemma. On the one hand, there is a severe, dire crisis. Dealing with it cannot be delayed. It's the most important issue that has arisen in human history. This generation, in fact, today's leaders and people will make a decision as to whether organized human society can survive in any decent, livable form. It's no less than that. That's one horn of the dilemma. The other horn of the dilemma is that we have to face the reality of the world. We have to find ways of reacting that are not only justified, but are also feasible and effective. So, for example, it would be entirely justified to send the most powerful person in the world, President of the United States, the Hague, for trial for severe crimes against humanity, and many lesser figures as well. That would be justified. It's not feasible. It's not effective. To choose approaches that are feasible and effective, we have to recognize the reality of the situation we face and adjust our approaches accordingly.
Then I asked him, what about the denialism that exists at the highest levels in the United States, where Donald Trump, who I, in my conversation with him, called a recognized sociopath, where Donald Trump is president?
So when the president of the United States says, I don't believe it, highly intelligent people like myself are not believers, that has an impact on much of the population. Especially so when it is echoed by the people right in the next lower level. So, for example, if you look at the Republican Party primaries in 2016, every single candidate either denied that global warming is taking place or said maybe it is, but we shouldn't do anything about it, which morally speaking is much worse. They were, incidentally, the ones praised as the adults in the room.
Then I asked him, how about corporate executives, the business community, and the general population?
So I'm sure that the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, is well aware of the effect of using fossil fuels freely. So how is he deciding to react to that? By increasing investment in fossil fuels. We know very well about the behavior of the major fossil fuel companies over the past 40 or 50 years. It's now well known that their scientists, ExxonMobil's scientists, were in the lead in discovering the significance and the threat of catastrophic environmental global change, and were presenting paper after paper to their own managers and executives, explaining the nature of the threat. And when James Hansen, in 1988, made his famous speech warning the world of the threat that we are facing, ExxonMobil management reacted, namely by shifting to funding of denialism and skepticism and increasing their the use of fossil fuels. We can go on. When the New York Times, a couple of weeks ago, runs a long front page, 1,000-word article on how President Trump is opening up a vast new fields in the west of the United States for oil exploration, for fracking. They do talk a little about environmental effects, namely it might harm the interests of ranchers who want to use those lands. It was literally one phrase in 1,000 words saying that by dropping restrictions on methane, it may lead to a very dangerous gas escaping into the environment. One phrase in 1,000 words.
And when I spoke to Noam, we spoke for well over an hour. He was very critical of the mainstream press for downplaying or underrepresenting the words climate change in their reporting of various things going on.
And all of this has an effect on the population. People listen. They see. They see that nobody seems to be taking it seriously. We see the results in polls among Republicans. Fully half of Republicans literally deny that global warming is taking place. Now, that includes people whose livelihoods are being destroyed by long droughts that are wiping out their sources of fish, of food, and so on. Say, no, it's not happening. That's half of Republicans. Of the other half, barely half say humans may be responsible. After all, if the man in charge says highly intelligent people like me don't believe it, who am I to question it? These are some of the realities we have to face.
Our governments are not telling us the truth, quite simply. They're not saying how severe the consequences are. They're hiding behind, it's always 10 years off or 12 years off, or the goal is by 2050. And he was very critical in general of governments, how they are not preparing people for the kinds of changes. So then I asked him, what would be the most effective approach to the task ahead of us, that of addressing this dire threat?
The effective approach is not simply to say, look, there's a dire emergency, you have to change everything you do. That's not going to work. What has to be done is to approach people, explaining that the situation is serious, is likely to be catastrophic unless we do something, and then go on to show what in fact is true, that efforts to deal with it are within range and will in fact make your life better. They're not going to destroy your life. We'd be much better off living in a green economy. You'd be much better off not spending 3 hours a day fighting traffic jams if you had an efficient mass transportation system. You'd be better off if you didn't have to take your kids to the doctor because they're suffering asthma because they can't breathe the air. If we had potable water, yes, things would be better. if we had an environment in which people could survive and live decent lives, everyone would be better, and it is within reach. There are things that we can do. There are things that are being done. Those are the kinds of approaches that have to be taken, and it has to be done. It's a difficult choice, because on the one hand, you recognize the enormous character of the catastrophe that's impending. On the other hand, you have to mute your responses to address the reality of the world in which you're trying to make a change. A hard decision. Often in many activist endeavors, these questions arise. It has to be managed and quickly. It's some of the things that are happening are almost beyond description. I'll just mention what may be the most evil document that has ever appeared in human history, which was barely mentioned in the news. Naturally, it's from a bureaucracy, Trump's National Highway Administration bureaucracy. Came out with a big study, a couple hundred pages a few weeks ago, concluding, explaining why all regulations on automotive emissions have to be ended. No regulations, free emissions. And they had a very rational argument. They said, if we extrapolate from what is happening now, by the end of the century, it will essentially be over the cliff. The temperature will have risen 3 or 4 degrees centigrade. Sea level will be very high. They radically underestimated it. People will be fleeing the coastal zones. It's all over. And emissions don't really contribute that much to it. So why not enjoy it while we can? The underlying assumption, of course, is everyone in the world is as criminally insane as we are. And nobody's going to do anything about it. That's the human species. So fine, let's rob while the planet burns, putting poor Nero in the shadows. He only fiddled while Rome burns. That's the world that we face. And we have to understand it, deal with it, grit our teeth, approach the problems constructively, effectively, and in a way that is feasible. Suppressing the justified feeling that we should be taking extremely dire actions. Now, that is not to say that we should not be doing those things. Major dramatic actions are very much in order. Efforts to create a general strike, regular massive protests, all of these things are important. They have to be shaped and geared so that they, instead of being offensive to people, they energize and mobilize them. That's the way they have to be developed, organized, and run. There's a range of activities that can be important, that can be done, from talking to your neighbor to installing LED lights to political action to demonstrating to bringing the dire character of the existing circumstances to general understanding. All of these things are within range. There can be no delay in executing them. These are the most significant questions that the human species has ever faced. And the record shows that it can succeed. We don't have a lot of time. This has to be done effectively, quickly, with careful thought. Actions like Extinction Rebellion, the teacher strike, Earth strike, aiming for a general strike. All of these things can be in parallel with efforts to simply introduce legislation to improve renewable energy, to cut back sharply on the use of fossil fuels, to end the insane expansion of fossil fuel exploration and lifting of fuels. All of that has to be done at the same time. No one's going to be brought to The Hague, but recognizing that it would be legitimate and justified is an important way of helping people comprehend the enormity of what is happening before their eyes. We should always bear in mind the slogan that Antonio Gramsci made famous. We should have pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the will. never been more important than it is now.
Pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the will. We have to act decisively and quickly. That's why we're here. That's not why the parties are here, unfortunately. They're involved in a ritual annual process of kicking the can down the road. Help us organize against this existential threat to life on Earth at scientistswarning.org. Again, my name is Stuart Scott. Thank you very much.
My thanks to Stuart Scott from scientistswarning.org for that conversation with 90-year-old Noam Chomsky. We just have time for part of my talk with Nicholas Rees from UNICEF. Danger in the air, how air pollution can affect brain development in young children. That is from UNICEF, the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund. We have Nicholas Rees on the line, the policy advocacy specialist who wrote the report. Nicholas, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be here.
You put out this report from UNICEF at the end of 2017, I believe, but the public still doesn't know that our exhaust pipe gas can hurt babies' brains in ways that could damage them for life, and that seems very serious. Is that based on relatively new science coming out behind this report?
Yeah, it's based on this, on a growing body of science on this, but it isn't all just absolutely new. I mean, we knew that when air pollution had lead in it, for example, in many parts of the world through the 70s and early 80s, we knew about it then, and the public and policymakers acted decisively when they found out the negative implications of lead in the air and in gasoline and how it could affect children's brains. More and more research now is surfacing over the last few years about how other types of pollutants, including a lot of the air pollution that we breathe now, could also actually have implications for children's cognitive development as well. And so it is a growing body of evidence, and it is increasingly, we're seeing more and more research coming out on this. And I think it's just a matter of time before we begin to ask ourselves the same questions that we asked ourselves in the past, is, okay, enough is enough. This is pretty horrible, and we have to stop the negative implications of air pollution on children's brains.
Well, you've got three clear pathways of how this can get into our brains in your report, and I'd like to just take them step by step. And the first is something called neuroinflammation. Could you tell us what that is and why that has anything to do with air pollution?
Basically, a lot of the particles, the most dangerous of air pollution particles are the really, really small ones. These are measured at 2.5 microns in diameter, to give you a sense, about a 30th of the width of a human hair in size. So it's extremely small. It's these really small particles that enter the lungs. And because they're so small, they can also enter the bloodstream and travel up to the brain, where studies are showing that these really small particles can damage the blood-brain barrier, which is essentially a thin, delicate membrane that protects the brain from toxic substances. So, and then in this damage can cause this neuroinflammation. Studies are also pointing to the effects of that neuroinflammation on impaired cognitive development and also even linking it to diseases that affect older populations, such as Alzheimer's.
And the second route for smog to get to the brain really seems strange to me. It appears that pollution can reach our brains directly through our nose. How does that work?
That's through the olfactory nerve, that's basically located just very close to the brain and through the nasal passage. If certain substances can get through that dimension, and studies are showing that it can reach the brain through that passageway as well.
And I had to look up one of the substances mentioned in the report, magnetite, the most magnetic material on Earth, and then how nanoparticles, as you described, very small particles of magnetite can work in the brain. So I go on to Google, and the first search shows that there's optimism that drugs could be injected with magnetite, and that would allow doctors to steer medicine to specific spots with a magnet. But according to your report, there's also a real downside of having more and more tiny magnetic bits entering our brains, and it looks like they that come even from the operation of the motors in our cars and trucks. How do we know that the magnetite from pollution getting into our heads is from those sources, those industrial sources, rather than the natural magnetite that is found on Earth?
Well, a lot of studies have looked at areas where magnetite is highly present in the air, in urban environments where there's a lot of traffic and where there's a lot of industrial pollution. They've demonstrated that populations in those who are exposed to the air in those areas have higher concentrations of magnetite in their body. And this basically creates oxidative stress in some similar ways that, as I was describing earlier, with lead. These are heavy metals in the air. They have similar effects on brain tissue and neurodegeneration.
The third pollutant that's mentioned in the report there, I know pretty well. In the early 1990s, I researched polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. I know that fossil fuel combustion produces PAHs, and so, by the way, do forest fires. But is there a way to describe to a general audience what these substances are?
It's a specific class of pollutant, and it is mostly it's linked with automobile traffic. Just taking a quick step back here, pollution is a very tricky thing to evaluate the effects of because there are so many different types of particles. There's, as you say, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, there's magnetite, and then there's even just particulate matter that is not necessarily, it's just very, very, very small. So there's so many different types of pollutants, and it's very hard. One of the big challenges here, and also I think why we're seeing such a growing body of research on the link between air pollution and brain development, has been trying to disentangle how different types of pollutants affect people in different ways. And now the science is getting better and better, and our methods are getting better and better, and the technology is getting better and better, which is allowing us to disentangle the effects of certain types of pollutants. So as we mentioned, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are a particular type of pollution. Again, it's really just one of the PM2.5s, which is really just referring to a size of particle. It's a specific type of pollutant, which is really comes from a lot of the fossil fuel combustion and, you know, essentially fossil fuel combustion and industrial fuel pollution. So, you know, I think one of the big challenges has been disentangling these, but now we're starting to be able to do it. And studies are showing with polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons that it's contributing to a loss of white matter in the brain. And white matter essentially contains nerve fibers that are critical for helping neurons in one part of the brain communicate with neurons in other parts of the brain. And it's this communication and the rapid level of communication that allows brains to develop and form, especially in very, very young children.
Right. The first, what is it, 3 months of a child's life, of a baby's life, is the most critical for the formation of the brain. Is that right?
Absolutely. Those first 1,000 days are absolutely critical to a child's future. During that time, it's essentially a critical window of brain development where neural connections are made, and then those neural connections replicate over and over throughout a child's life. And so disruptions during those first 1,000 days can have long-lasting effects on a child's brain development.
Where are the most people being affected by the worst air?
What we did was we looked at some NASA maps that measure air pollution annually around the world. And as one can expect, the highest levels of air pollution we're seeing in South Asia and East Asia. And that includes extremely high levels of numbers of kids affected. But I do want to just point out, though, that that is outdoor air pollution. And there are huge numbers of kids living in other parts of the world where solid fuels are burned inside homes. And so that does not account for the levels of exposure that young kids might be exposed to, and parents as well, who are living in homes where solid fuels are used for cooking and heating. And the levels of air pollution in the kitchen, for example, can be just as high, if not even higher, than some of the most polluted cities in the world. And so we really have to, when we think about air pollution, it's obviously there are some of the cities in the world where pollution is really high a lot of the time, and that needs to be addressed. But we also need to think about the microenvironment where children live and their exposure to indoor cooking in a way that where improper ventilation prevents air pollution from escaping the room where a kid may be.
And then we have another new study published in August 2018, this one by Chinese academics, and the title is The Impact of Exposure to Air Pollution on Cognitive Performance. And as a writer named Kevin Loria said in the World Economic Forum, this study found, and I'll quote him here, chronic exposure to air pollution appears to cause detrimental effects on cognition that get worse throughout life, potentially increasing risk factors for degenerative diseases like dementia and Alzheimer's. And that's basically what you were finding in your report, is it not?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, and this is yet another, and, you know, we published this report about a year ago, but it was since then we've just seen studies like these more and more coming out, which are, you know, which are pointing to these links between air pollution and cognitive development. And this is very much in line with the growth of literature that we're seeing on this topic. And so, as I said at the beginning, you know, at what point is enough enough? At what point do we have to say this is posing a considerable risk to our children and their futures, and their ability to learn and reach their full potential? And at what point are we going to say that we need to really do something about this? You know, air pollution has made a lot of links between high levels of exposure and risks to child survival. We've known this for a long time. We're increasingly seeing this growing body of evidence affecting their potential learning and so forth. We're not going to be successful in preventing child death and improving their potential in the future if we don't address environmental risks.
I totally agree, but I do see this caution that isn't your report talking about an increasing percentage of damaged kids rather than all kids? I mean, pollution, does it hurt everyone, or can we still see a lot of healthy people and very intelligent people coming from highly polluted areas?
Oh, of course. We're not saying that an exposure, you know, if you live in a polluted city, that is an absolute, you're not going to, you know, we're saying that there's growing body of evidence that it is affecting the full performance or the full potential of brain development. That's not to say that you're not going to get very smart kids growing up in potentially highly polluted areas. That's definitely, but the risks are there, and everyone from parents to policymakers needs to know those risks and to do what they can to prevent exposure. You know, we're not saying leave the city, but you can do what you can to prevent exposure, even if you live in highly polluted cities. Make sure that even planning when you travel during the day can help reduce exposure when you're outside at high levels of pollution. Because you want to minimize all the negative implications that could possibly affect kids, even if we're not talking about a major impact on cognitive development. We are talking about studies showing links between these issues.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Nicholas Rees, Policy Advocacy Specialist for UNICEF. We're talking about how combustion engines and our industrial society can make some of us sick right from the start of life. I wonder, is it fair, Nicholas, to compare fossil-powered air pollution to smoking cigarettes? Adult can decide to become more healthy and quit smoking, but, you know, a baby can't really defend themselves, and if their brains are not developed well in those first 1,000 days, that doesn't happen later. So we have to, as a society, defend our babies. I mean, that's just so basic, and yet we're not doing it, really.
Right, absolutely. We have to, at a certain point, decide that we need to act on this because it's clearly becoming too much of a risk.
And we've been talking about a report, Danger in the Air, How Air Pollution Can Affect Brain Development in Young Children. You can find links for this free report and the science behind it in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for telling us about this, Nick.
Thank you, Alex. Pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Once again, we are all out of time. Tune in again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
And it is the Taylor Report, CIUT 9.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. By the way, Phil Connon is here, and he'll be in with us later on. And we're going to be talking to Sarah Flounders about China in the latter part of the show. I believe Otis Richmond has joined us. Are you there, Otis?
Yes, sir. How are you doing today?
And very well. It's nice to be talking to the bluesologist. And last week, I promised everybody we would talk to you, and we listened to the very music that we intended to speak about. Unfortunately, we didn't get you, so we're sorry. What I would like to know is how you could connect the three matters that we talked about, which were Sam Cooke, singer, Otis Redding, and Muhammad Speaks. Now, this is little riddle. So you put those three things together, if you can.
Well, let me say that when Sam Cooke passed away, he was murdered in Los Angeles in December of 1964. They found a copy of Muhammad's book, Muhammad Speaks, in his car. But he attended the mosque in Los Angeles, or I guess it was the mosque of the what we call Temple 27th. It was on 56th and Broadway. Mm-hmm. Pardon me. And there's a book called From the Dead Level, Malcolm X and Me by Hakeem Jamal. He was married to Malcolm X. He's Malcolm X's cousin by marriage. But Hakeem Jamal was from Boston, but he moved to Los Angeles. And I knew him very well because we used to go to the Aquarian Spiritual Center. That was a great bookstore in Los Angeles. But he talks about seeing Sam Cooke at Temple 27, Mosque 27, on 56th and Broadway. And the minister at that time was John Shabazz. He's still alive, and I guess with Louis Farrakhan now, but he talks about how Malcolm X was in the audience and listening to John Shabazz speak.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Otis Redding, there was a book recently put out by a guy by the name of Jonathan Gould.
Uh-huh.
And the book is called Epic, Otis Redding's biography. Mm-hmm. Sheds light on the singer's life and times. But Gould maintained, he said that Otis Redding had no contact with the Nation of Islam. He didn't know anything about the Muhammad Speaks. And basically, Otis was a nice liberal guy who got along with everybody and, you know, Kumbaya stuff. I'm probably mispronouncing it. You know, just flower child, you know.
Yes.
And this is a guy by the name of Daryl Cowherd wrote this guy basically put in his book that Otis had no contact with the Nation of Islam. And mm-hmm. this is what Daryl Cowherd wrote.
Uh-huh.
Quote, simply put, that's a lie, because I conducted an interview with Otis Redding that was published in Muhammad Speaks September 23rd, 1966, and I have a copy of that published article to substantiate what I'm saying. And we went on, I published the article, I think it was in the San Francisco Bay View,
mm-hmm.
and Daryl Cowherd flipped out. And he flipped out, and he and Daryl Cowherd had a little battle, and of course.
No, I think you got two guys fighting the same name. One of them is the other guy, right?
Cowherd is the guy is on the right side, and Jonathan Gould is the guy that was.
That's it. We got to get our cowboys and the other guys separated here. The bandits.
Yeah. So that was.
That's a real revelation. By the way, what a gutless character to put a negative in there like that, saying, oh, he didn't have any association. Well, simple research would have, or a few asking around would have told him he was wrong.
Oh, well, he had interviewed Otis Redding's, I think he had interviewed Otis Redding's manager, who was a white guy by the name of Phil Walden. Phil Walden was a great manager and so on and so forth, but he
was trying to protect the brand, right?
I don't know. I really don't know what the situation was. What that situation was, because Otis Redding was not, and I'm not trying to say anything negative about Otis, but Otis Redding was not a Cub Scout.
Uh-huh.
He he had gone to prison. I mean, he didn't go into prison, but I mean, Otis was up on a murder rap, you know, because he was a guy that didn't take any nonsense, and he actually came back at just when he was getting big. He actually came back to his hometown, and someone had jumped on one of his buddies, and Otis actually they went with guns and
had a conversation,
some retaliation, uh-huh. and Otis almost went to prison for that, but he got off.
Yeah. Well, by the way, life—the idea that you have a big top record is going to protect you from racism or from, you know, violence in tough communities—that it would not be true. You're not shielded.
Otis was bigger than Elvis Presley in 1967, the Melody Maker.
As far as I'm concerned, he still
was,
is.
He was the greatest, the world's best male vocalist. That was Melody Maker said that in 1967.
This is Otis Richmond. By the way, I want to ask you quickly and make sure I get this. Why would he have given that interview to Muhammad Speaks? You know, he had to understand who he's talking to. He must have, there had to be some mutual respect.
Oh, like I say, there was a movement going on at that particular time, and just like today, you know, Beyonce and Jay-Z and people like that are identifying with elements, Black Lives Matter, and so on and so forth. So, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm not saying this is Otis's case, but. Mm-hmm. You know, artists, when you have a movement, artists genuinely believe in the movement, and other people have to identify with the movement because they have to protect, they have to protect their brand because of the masses are out there hollering and screaming and fighting back.
Wait, so, by the way, your story ties in. I like this. You mentioned like Sam Cooke now, and we have Otis, and you really have shown the connection Muhammad Speaks. The Sam Cooke and Muhammad Ali stood together at the microphone and really did a really nice song together. And all that sort of, you could see that just being part of that general culture and politics of the time. If Sam Cooke was attending that mosque, he could just as easily have run into Ali.
Yeah, but I don't want to change the subject, but I think Joe Frazier could out-sing Ali.
Don't put him in the same.
But, I mean, Joe Frazier could sing circles around Muhammad Ali.
Well, yeah, but could he get Sam Cooke to sing with him? That was fun. You've seen that clip. That is a lot of fun, that clip.
Oh, no, that's beautiful. Yeah. Hell, and he said, "That's a Sam Cooke. He's pretty just like me," and blah blah. Yeah. I watched that all.
Well,
I
now
watched,
that you mentioned Sam Cooke couldn't, Sam Cooke couldn't defeat Frazier in a fight for sure. We're going to give that one to Frazier. I like the way that Ali would say it, Joe Frazier. I really appreciate it. That's a great. Those are great stories. I got to ask you: did you write this? You put all this in one column for us sometime, or is it already in existence?
I think I have put that in a column. I think I'll send it to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no. We'll post it and everything. But that's. I think people need to know about this. A lot of these artists, we just buried the most famous woman in modern singing, and it turned out Muhammad Speaks was very present at her funeral and being passed out.
Oh, you mean Muhammad Speaks, that they had a special edition? Gerald Horn sent me a copy of that. That was they did a special edition for Aretha Franklin and passed it out at the funeral. Right, right. That was Minister Farrakhan in the Nation of Islam. Definitely, right.
Yeah.
Aretha Franklin had stood with the Nation of Islam when they were attacked. She came to the mosque and supported the Nation of Islam.
I bet we could show, if we did the research, that there's probably more artists identify with them than do not amongst the black artists.
Well, many of the artists had joined the Nation of Islam, the Delphonics, and then you had Joe Tex, pardon me, Yusuf Haziz. He was in the Nation. He was a minister for a while, and you had—
We can still call him Joe Tex, okay?
Yeah. Yusuf Haziz, Joe Tex, and the Delphonics, many of the artists that joined the Nation of Islam.
Yeah.
And it was the group, the group that sang Kiss and Say Goodbye. The fifth member of the Manhattans, he joined the Nation of Islam and left. He left the movement. Mm-hmm. Or he left the Manhattans and joined the Nation of Islam, and then when he made his transition, he'd become a Sunni. But
Otis, we're going to have to be going. So I want to ask you, where can people find you on the net or on the radio? And
I do a radio show with Melinda Francis. We do a show on Uhuru Radio on Black Power 96. You can just Google that.
Okay.
And I write a column in the Bernie Spear newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And I have my own blog, WordPress.blog. And
all right.
You can put my name in Google and
That's right. I forget what the age we're living in. I should just say Norman Otis Richmond and do your own homework. Everybody would just go and get it faster than I could hunt it up. Norman, we're going to, I think you'll probably appreciate it, we're going to go out of here with Otis Redding singing Merry Christmas, Baby. I bet you know
that. Nice. That's a nice tune. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Catherine Tataquin, Executive Director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, who examines President Trump's attack on immigrants and his demand for a border wall, which has led to the current government shutdown. Lee Chapman of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who assesses H.R. 1, the first major package of legislation proposed by the new Democratic House majority, which calls for voting rights protection and ethics reform. And Anstress Farewell, president of the New Haven Urban Design League, who discusses city parking issues, which impact sustainable public transportation and urban planning. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Soon after being sworn into office, Brazil's president Jair Bolsonaro launched an assault on indigenous people in the Amazon rainforest. The new president issued a 120-day decree putting the agricultural ministry in charge of indigenous affairs, a change which impacts nearly 1 million people. The ministry, now overseeing the management of public forests, will also have the power to rule on land claims. Environmental activists blasted the move, saying it will increase deforestation and spark violence against indigenous people. Land claims were previously handled by the Indigenous Affairs Agency. Alarming many, Bolsonaro's health minister, Luis Enrique Mendetta, pledged to cut government health spending for indigenous communities. According to Amazon Watch, President Bolsonaro has his eyes on developing the mineral-rich indigenous territory known as Raposa Sierra do Sol. Analysts worry that the world's fourth-largest democracy could drift back to military dictatorship. The pro-Bolsonaro governor of Rio de Janeiro, for example, is calling for the deployment of helicopter-borne snipers to execute suspected criminals. In 2018, the Rio police killed over 1,400 people. That number is expected to rise in the new year. In the ultimate act of protest, a Tunisian television reporter set himself on fire in a chilling cell phone video posted on Christmas Eve from the city of Kasserine. The 32-year-old reporter complained of widespread hunger and massive unemployment. According to the New Yorker magazine, the reporter, Abdurazak Zorgi, committed suicide just days after the 8th anniversary of the Arab Spring, which was triggered when a Tunisian street vendor set himself on fire in protest over corruption and youth unemployment. The Arab Spring rocked the Middle East with citizen uprisings in Egypt and Bahrain and sparked civil wars in Syria and Yemen. The self-immolation of the local TV reporter led to renewed protests in cities across Tunisia and debate over what to do about massive unemployment. Tunisia, a former French colony, emerged out of the Arab Spring as the most credible democracy in the Arab world. However, successive Tunisian governments have failed to create enough jobs for the educated, to address pressing needs ranging from housing to health services, and to provide for a society's rising expectations. Before dawn each morning, hundreds of Mexican-American schoolchildren cross the border, passing U.S. Border Patrol officers to ride school buses to classes in Luna County, New Mexico. The nearly 850 children who cross each weekday are American citizens who live in or near Palomas with their Mexican parents. Mexican children have attended these New Mexico schools for decades and are warmly welcomed by local officials. In recent years, more parents deported from the U.S. to Mexico have moved close to the border so their U.S.-born children can go to U.S. schools in order to receive a better education. It is an arrangement that has been in place for generations, long enough to become normal and accepted in a region where economic and ancestral ties bridge the man-made line that divides the two nations. The closest Mexican hospital in this remote border area is in Juarez, 2 hours to the east. So in the event of medical emergencies, U.S. Customs officers let patients through to go to the hospital 45 minutes north in Deming. Arsenio Romero, superintendent of the Deming Public Schools, thinks everyone in America should spend a morning in his border bus stop. While the immigration debate has turned toxic, he says, watching five-year-olds walk through customs with passports hanging from their necks might change perceptions about who belongs in this country. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
With the partial government shutdown entering its third week, pressure is growing in Washington for a resolution of the political battle over President Trump's demand for more than $5 billion from Congress to build his wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. While both the newly Democratic-controlled House of Representatives and GOP-controlled Senate had approved continuing budget resolutions to reopen the 9 federal departments closed down, the president has refused to end the shutdown until Congress meets his demands. The shutdown affects more than 800,000 federal workers in the Departments of Agriculture, Commerce, Justice, Homeland Security, Housing and Urban Development, Interior, State, Transportation, and Treasury. Many of these workers have been furloughed, while others deemed essential must work without pay. Ironically, the shutdown has weakened staffing of the TSA, which enforces security at the nation's airports. In a misleading primetime address to the nation on January 8th, Trump argued that the U.S. faces a national security crisis on the southern border that must be addressed by building the wall he pledged would be paid for by Mexico. Your reporter spoke with Catherine Tuktakin, executive director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Here she discusses Trump's attack on immigrants, the forced separation of families, and the current shutdown, as she challenges the assertion that a crisis exists on the U.S.-Mexico border.
This isn't the first time that we've seen him use this tactic to hold people hostage. So in the past, he's held, almost 800,000 Dreamers, undocumented youth who benefited from the DACA program, hostage over the wall. He has... I think tried to hold children, the separation of children from their parents at the border, as hostage to to his agenda, it is extremely frustrating. And when you look at the human impact on immigrants, on children, and now on hundreds of thousands of federal workers and their families. Who are going without pay and have an uncertain future, as a being held hostage for what was his campaign promise. And we've seen some news in the last week that actually the phrase "build the wall" was being used by his campaign as a way to focus his attention as an undisciplined candidate. When he was campaigning. But what we saw was that the phrase, the call to build the wall, was used, over and over in campaign rallies. And essentially, it was a code for, keep the immigrants out. It was a code for his anti-immigration policies. And now we see this campaign slogan or promise, an attempt to turn that into policy. And of course, it's been met with lots of resistance, certainly from the Democratic Party, but also I think increasingly, frustration by members of the Republican Party as well. You know, a major critique from many sides on the just the concept of a wall as national security, but also, you know, looking more broadly at what a wall means in terms of militarization of the border, it's at what border enforcement has actually meant over a number of years in terms of increasing the likelihood of migrant deaths, human rights violations, damage to border communities, to the environment. It's a very fragile environment at the border, and there's already been considerable damage just by the encroachment of a more militarized border.
Catherine, I wonder if you would respond to Donald Trump and his administration's characterization of a crisis, an emergency, a national emergency on our southern border. I've read accounts where there's actually fewer immigrants crossing the border than there were years ago. Provide a reality check for our listeners, if you would, about the quote-unquote crisis or emergency at the U.S.-Mexico border.
The reality is that border crossings have declined over the last 12 years. And if there is a crisis, what we're seeing is certainly the humanitarian crisis that has emerged in Central America. And I think many people by now have become more familiar with the problem of persistent poverty, of violence, and what's described as the Northern Triangle, the countries of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, which are identified as among the most dangerous countries in the entire world. And what we've seen of the Central American exodus, also described as the migrant caravan, are really families who have been leaving Central America and traveling as a group, because that is the safest way for them to travel, to flee those conditions, and to try to reach safe haven. They are no different from the millions of people around the world who have similarly sought safety, leaving situations of crisis. So if there is a crisis, it's there. And we are, you know, have been using this false narrative of a national security or manufacturing a crisis, really by not implementing a strong humanitarian response, by cutting back on access to refugee resettlement, by trying to close the doors to asylum seekers. So we have been reneging, the United States government, that is, on really our national laws with regards to asylum, but also our obligations under international agreements to provide safe havens to those who qualify. So it is a bit of a manufactured crisis. I think there's been news over the last couple of days when the White House was trying to argue that there were thousands of terrorists trying to cross the border. They identified thousands of terrorists, and apparently, you know, the information that they were using was the fact that there are over 3,000 people who are on a no-fly list. These are people who've been identified for various reasons, including people who might have the same name as someone who is identified as a suspected terrorist, who have been identified because they've sought to fly. They're not people who have who are crossing the border, and the State Department has had to admit that, in fact, since 9/11, we have not caught one terrorist crossing the U.S.-Mexico border.
That was Catherine Tactakin, Executive Director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Learn more about national organizations challenging Trump's crackdown on immigrants and refugees and working for comprehensive immigration reform by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The new Democratic Party majority, which took control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 8 years on January 3rd, quickly introduced their first major package of legislation, H.R. 1, on January 4th. The bill addresses three major issues: the protection and expansion of voting rights, campaign finance reform, and strengthening the government's ethics laws. The legislation's proposals include overturning the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling that open the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money in U.S. politics, public financing of federal campaigns, requiring the president and vice president, both candidates and office holders, to disclose 10 years of tax returns, establishing a new national automatic voter registration system, outlawing partisan gerrymandering in federal elections, and prohibiting partisan-driven purges of voter rolls. Your reporter spoke with Lee Chapman, Voting Rights Program Director, with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who assesses the package of proposals in H.R. 1 with a focus on challenging voter suppression laws and prospects for the bill's success, given that President Trump and the GOP-controlled Senate are highly unlikely to support this legislation.
So H.R. 1 is also known as For the People Act, and it's a bold, ambitious bill that was just introduced by House Democrats last week, and it's one of the first major bills of this new Congress. And the bill is really about putting the government back in the hands of the people. It does three things. So one, it makes it easier, not harder, for people to vote in our country. Two, it aims to end the big dominance of money in politics. And three, it has provisions ensuring that public officials work for the public interest. But at the leadership conference, we're primarily focused on the voting rights provision of the bill because our democracy works the best when everyone can participate. I wanted to talk about some of the key provisions that are potentially really transformative in this bill. So one of them is automatic voter registration. So under H.R. 1, it would allow for there to be nationwide automatic voter registration. So that means when someone goes to their DMV or any agency in their state to either update their driver's license, their information would be automatically sent to the Secretary of State's office so that they're registered. And this would have an impact of having more than 50 million more additional people on the voter rolls. So this is a huge transformational change if this were to become law. Another key reform to highlight is H.R. 1. Would also restore the right to vote for people with felony convictions around the country. So there are some states where if you have a felony conviction, you lose your right to vote permanently. And this impacts about 5 million people around the country. Under H.R. 1, if this went into effect, we would have not only the 50 more million people on the rolls through automatic voter registration, but there would also be 5 million people with previous felony convictions who could participate in our democracy.
Lee, maybe you could describe the progress that's being made in this newly Democratic Party-controlled House of Representatives to bring up legislation that would restore the Voting Rights Act. And what are the prospects in the U.S. Senate for doing the same thing?
So actually, since the Supreme Court gutted Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, there has been an effort to introduce legislation to restore and modernize the Voting Rights Act, because it's important that we have Section 5 preclearance again so we can stop that laws from going into place before they do. Terry Sewell, Representative Terry Sewell from Alabama, she's been the main sponsor of the Voting Rights Advancement Act, which is a piece of legislation that has been introduced in previous Congresses, and she's planning on introducing it again in this Congress. The key thing about your question about the Senate, what's the possibility of this passing in the Senate is, voting rights should be a nonpartisan issue. No matter what political party that you're a member of, you should want everyone in our democracy to participate. And unfortunately, voting rights has become something that has been politicized over the last few years, but it shouldn't. If people care about economic justice or immigration reform or, education, every legislator should support restoring the Voting Rights Act and restore the key provisions of H.R. 1.
H.R. 1 is likely to pass in the House of Representatives, but the Republicans still control the Senate and Donald Trump is still in the White House. I think from outside looking in, it appears that both the Senate and Trump would reject the set of reforms. Where does H.R. 1 go from here if it passes the House but gets blocked by the White House and the Senate?
Yeah, so it probably will pass the House relatively quickly. House Democrats have said that they are planning on voting on it within the next few weeks. It will go to the Senate. There will probably be a Senate companion bill that will be introduced. But I think this is a time where voters need to put pressure on their members of Congress that they have elected. It's time for voters to call your member of Congress, no matter if they're a Democrat or Republican, and say that you want this bill to pass, you want them to support this bill. So this is the pivotal moment where we can't just say, oh, it's never going to pass the Senate. We need to actually put public pressure on our elected members of Congress to make this a priority and to hold them accountable.
That was Lee Chapin, Voting Rights Program Director with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Learn more about H.R. 1 and its package of voting rights, campaign finance, and ethics reforms by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Years ago, the State of Connecticut Department of Transportation proposed to build a second parking garage adjacent to the existing one at New Haven's Union Station on what's now a ground-level surface parking lot as a way to attract single-occupancy drivers out of their cars and onto the train. Train service in this region includes Metro North to New York City, Amtrak offering service along the Eastern Seaboard, Shoreline East, and a new commuter line that travels north from New Haven to Hartford and Springfield, Massachusetts. But the train station garage proposal has always faced opposition from city officials and urban advocates who say the 1,000 cars it would take off the highways is a drop in the bucket, while adding 1,000 cars to city streets riding to the garage would create a gigantic bottleneck. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Anstress Farrell, president of the New Haven Urban Design League, which sponsored a two-day event at the city's downtown library on January 4th, where planning experts and residents had a chance to provide feedback on the garage project. Farewell maintains that the funds to build the $60 million garage could be put to much better use elsewhere, framing the New Haven proposal in the context of national sustainable public transportation and urban planning goals.
We wrote a report back in 2016 to the DOT that said this was a very problematic project and that it wrote an environmental impact evaluation that really showed failure in every possible way for this project, for its impact on stormwater, air quality. They'd cut down every tree in the area, all of it gone. And even with that, they didn't have a plan for bus service. There wasn't a sufficient plan to make it safe for more people to ride bikes or walk in the area. So it was essentially a plan for 1,000 cars that would cost $60 million. They said that in order to increase access to Union Station, we needed to maximize the amount of parking we could build there. And I feel very strongly they've asked the wrong question. You need to first say, why do you want to increase access to Union Station? And the why is important. Is it because we're going to become a hub of the Northeast Corridor high-speed rail, for commuter rail, for all of the pieces that will need to fit together there? Once you answer that, then you say, what do we need to develop in the area to support all of those regional and local systems and make train service really work well for our New Haven residents in the region? If this is a $60 million plan that will simply take 1,000 cars a day off the highway, that does very little even for the highway. But you put 1,000 cars on Union Avenue at rush hour, and it's a disaster for everyone else that uses Union Avenue. In any other city, a parcel like this right next to the train station would be what realtors call a 100% lot. It's one of the most valuable pieces of land in the city. Can you imagine if New York knocked down the Pan Am building to build a mega parking garage? That's how we need to think of this, that when our train station was built in 1913, It was in the middle of a dense urban area with a street grid. It was all buildings and houses. And then we destroyed our trolley system and knocked down most of 60% of the buildings down there. So what we need to do is think of a proper thing that takes advantage of being at the train station, like a big mixed-use project. It could be a hotel conference center. It could be a corporate headquarters. So that would provide expansion of our tax base that we desperately need now. You know, we're facing extreme budget problems both in the state and the city. If you have followed the work of Norman Garrick of the Yukon Transportation Institute, one of the things that he has shown in his research and work is that as you expand parking, cities' tax base goes down, and also the number of jobs. And if you think about it, if you had, let's say, even a lab building, the value of that building and its equipment would be far beyond a parking garage. That's more taxes. Also, how many people work in a lab building or a hotel or a business center compared to a parking garage that's mostly automated? So cities that don't control the development of parking end up with reduced tax bases and fewer jobs. New Haven in the state, we cannot keep going in this direction. It's totally unsustainable. So this isn't right in terms of building a livable urban environment, but it also is very backwards and isn't attending to all of the best up-to-date research that's been available really since 2005 about the impact of parking garages on urban economies. So this is a big step backwards.
And I'm sure New Haven isn't the only city in the country that's facing these challenges.
Well, I think it's cities all over the country are realizing that the development practices of the redevelopment era that were focused on cars were actually destroying the economy and the livability of cities. So this is really central to a whole national movement reevaluating the impact of parking on cities. As many people say, parking is like the dark matter of a city, and it has distorted everything about the urban environment and set up habits of mind that actually don't go with livable cities. So, yes, this is a kind of intellectual battle and real political battle that cities are facing nationwide.
That was Anstress Farewell, president of the New Haven Urban Design League. Learn more about sustainable public transportation and urban design issues by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, WZMO in Marion, Ohio, KOPA Res Radio in Pala, California, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Babies in chains. They're beautiful babies when you see photos of those tykes. Bright-eyed, curious, little bundles of endless energy. Except their energies thrown into metallic American cages called detention centers. Separated from their parents by the U.S. government, have left their little forms, drawn into death by American carelessness, American uncaring, American hatreds. Jacqueline and Felipe, children of South America, brought north to taste a little bit of America, have been ignored into non-existence because they're children of migrants and thus demonized. They were children of sunlight, of childish glee and joy, of life renewing itself. They could have been children of a new America were it not for the president of old America, who sent them into detention for being the wrong color, the wrong language. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Opinion. I hope to read it in a few days, and then I'll have more thoughts. But, you know, I've had discussions with counsel, and they've told me some good things that they've read. But it's a beginning. That's all I can say. And I will say this in addition. I'm not sure of this, but it seems to me this is the first time I've been in front of a Pennsylvania judge who wasn't paid by the other side, speaking of the FOP. And maybe that's why it happened. So it's a little too early to say. I'll keep thinking and keep looking and keep working. Thank you for your question. Centoya Brown, and she has spent half her life
prison. Why? Because she shot and killed a man when she was 16 years old. Why? Because the man she killed was her pimp, who raped her, exploited her, and planned to sell her like a loaf of bread. Stars such as the popular singer Rihanna have raised their voices in her defense. In an Instagram posting, Rihanna wrote, quote, "Imagine at the age of 16 being sex trafficked by a pimp named Cutthroat. After days of being repeatedly drugged and raped by different men, you were purchased by a 43-year-old child predator who took you to his home to use you for sex." Santoya gathered her will, took his gun, and shot him. She was certified as an adult at the tender age of 16 and sentenced to 60 years in prison. Over 500,000 people signed a petition demanding her freedom. And just a few days ago, Santoya Brown had her sentence commuted to time served by Tennessee's governor. Santoya Brown, now an adult woman of 32 years, is now free. Free to leave a lifetime of nightmares. Free to fly from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Pennsylvania state prisoner, who is the named plaintiff in a civil rights suit against the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. The other two plaintiffs are David Maldonado and Daniel Levia, is suing DOC on behalf of thousands of Pennsylvania state prisoners suffering from hepatitis C and its notorious side effects. That case may have reached a powerful turning point, as both sides have reached a proposed settlement agreement. In that proposed settlement, Chimenti et al. Versus Pennsylvania DOC proposes to treat 1,500 men and women, of course, who have F2, F3,
and F4 fibrosis or Metavir scores within 6 months, and an additional 1,500 hepatitis patients during the next year with powerful drugs known as DAAs or direct acting antiviral drugs. After 2020, 2,000 people are to be treated annually. The settlement agreement has to first be approved by the U.S. District Court in Philadelphia after a hearing in early February 2019. If the judge agrees, the go date will be July 1st, 2019. Mr. Chimenti was seeking Hep C treatment as far back as 2010 when it was determined that he suffered stage 4 cirrhosis of his liver due to the infection. He and his co-plaintiffs filed suit initially in 2015 and in 2017 filed an amended complaint. Earlier in 2018, the court declared Chimenti a class action. The Chimenti class is represented by renowned civil rights lawyer David Radovsky and Su Ming Ye of the Pennsylvania Institutional Law Project in Philadelphia. If this proposed settlement agreement is signed into law, it will be a groundbreaking change in how the state and prisons handle hepatitis C cases. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Might the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change be understating the severity of human-induced climate change? How severely are the poles being impacted by global warming, and how will melting Arctic ice impact the world's climate? What are the consequences of the melting of glacial ice? How significant is the damage to Earth's oceans, and what are some of the broader impacts on the Earth's ecosystems? What role has humanity's disconnect from the natural world had on the escalating threat to life on our world posed by anthropogenic climate change? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on the occasion of a week of worldwide demonstrations for climate action, we devote our program to a look at the ongoing climate crisis with two analysts, Paul Beckwith, a University of Ottawa-based climate systems scientist and researcher, and Dar Jamail, independent journalist and author of a recent book on climate change's impacts in flashpoints around the globe. On this week's program, The End of Ice and Other Threats to the Planet, talking climate change with Paul Beckwith and Dar Jamail. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 11th, 2019. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the traditional territory of the Nihiyawak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The success of the 9/11 Lawyers Committee in obtaining the consent of the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York to, quote, comply with the provisions of 18 U.S.C. 3332, unquote, which requires the convening of a federal grand jury to examine the unexamined 9/11 evidence, has impressed True Publica, as no U.S. attorney would convene a grand jury on the basis of a conspiracy theory. Clearly, compelling evidence has been presented to the U.S. attorney. Obviously, Washington expects the Justice Department to escape from the bind into which it has been put by the Lawyers Committee, an escape that the prostitute media will aid and abet. Nevertheless, the escape will likely reinforce the public's view that the government is afraid of the evidence and is no more likely to follow it than in the case of President Kennedy's assassination, Robert Kennedy's assassination, the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty, and a large number of other officially covered-up crimes. More and more people will come to realize that ad hominem name-calling is not an acceptable response to evidence. That comes from the article, A Majority of Americans Do Not Believe the Official 9/11 Story, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted January 9th, originally published on the author's blog site, Paul Craig Roberts, Institute for Political Economy. Canadian and Italian tourists feared kidnapped in Burkina Faso, was the recent headline in the BBC, a day after clashes there claimed 46 lives. The BBC didn't cover the clashes online, nor did they cover a terrorist attack there a few days prior, or the country's trade deals with China. If the tragic events had happened in Europe, though, the media would have been all over it. We see similar scenarios with the recent media coverage of tourists robbed in Brazil, just as a president who is arguably more racist, sexist, and homophobic than Trump has taken power, yes, it's possible, of a tourist murdered in Morocco and the killings in a Mexican tourist resort. From deprioritizing the lives of locals in poor countries to downplaying global inequality, racism, and condescension, the way Western news agencies do international news is deeply harmful. That comes from the article, Everything the Western Mainstream Media Outlets Get Wrong When Covering Poor Countries, by Tamara Pearson, posted January 9th. Given what we already know about the White Helmets' involvement in organ harvesting, kidnapping, thievery, fake news, staged rescues, and assorted terrorist activities, their anticipated involvement in preparations for yet another false flag attack is credible. As Canadians, we must demand an end to our government's war on Syria. Canada should open its embassy in Syria and resume diplomatic relations. Furthermore, Canada should leave NATO. And Canada must be held to account for the crimes that it has committed against the sovereign nation of Syria and for the crimes that it continues to commit against the sovereign nation of Syria. That comes from the article, "The War on Syria, Are the White Helmets Preparing Another Chemical Weapons False Flag?" by Mark Taliano, posted January 9th. It is time for citizens in the democracies of Europe and North America to openly discuss the global spiral of violence which we currently are in. Of course, not only democracies are driving this spiral of violence, but it seems important to me that we hear talk openly about the Western share in this escalation. The crimes of the NATO countries must be analyzed honestly so that the necessary consequences can be drawn from them. The French and British illegal attack on Egypt in 1956, France's illegal terrorist attack on the Greenpeace ship in 1985, and the American illegal attack on Syria in 2017 clearly demonstrate that democracies are also driving this spiral of violence. That comes from the article, "War Criminals at Large" by Dr. Danielle Ganser, posted January 9th, translated by Terj Malloy from an article in Rubicon. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. This is Michael Welch, host and producer of the Global Research News Hour. As this program goes live to air on Friday, January the 11th, there's a youth climate action taking place here in Winnipeg, Manitoba, on Treaty 1 territory. Youth are cutting classes and have gathered at our province's political hub, the Manitoba Legislative Building, inspired by the Swedish activist Greta Thunberg. They are demanding leadership of our elected representatives on climate. Nina Zsigic is a student and a volunteer reporter with host radio station CKUW 95.9 FM. She's speaking to us from the site. Nina, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi!
So tell us what's happening right there at the ledge this afternoon.
So right now there's a lot of kids out here from all age groups. We have quite a few high schools, a few middle schools, and a lot of littler kids, all with signs and different things to say. Everybody's got their own voice. People have come out here. They really want the Canadian government to recognize and to, make more action to help decarbonize the planet and to really hear our voices and hear the youth because we have a lot to say. There is, like I said, a lot of people out here, and they're doing some speeches. There are some speakers. And I believe there will be some kids speaking as well.
Okay. What are people telling you, the people that you've been talking to so far, about why they're there?
I spoke to a few high school students and a few younger students, and a lot of them were saying that they're worried that the lasting effects will come soon, and they're scared that nobody's doing anything, and that they're scared that a lot of people, that the government isn't making enough effort to change what's currently going on. So yeah, that's what I got mostly from the students.
Okay. Do they have any specific demands of what they want the government to do?
I didn't hear too much. I heard a lot about going green, using more solar energy instead of using coal, and just being more sustainable and working more on sustainable energy than other sources.
Okay, so about how many people did you say they're there?
There seems to be right now about 50, maybe 50 kids total. There's a lot of people out here.
Okay. And they're outside right now?
Yes, right now we're on the front steps of the ledge.
Okay, and so they're planning to go in a little bit later and...
Yeah, the plans are to go in and... deliver a message inside, and then start to talk a little bit about our plans for February 1st, so the next Friday, to do another rally of some sort. So we're gonna plan out something new.
Okay. Now, is this action open to the general public or is it just students?
It's open to the general public, but it's completely youth-led. So it's all kids out here, mostly kids rallying, and it's really just... Sorry, they're coughing. It's really mostly a gathering to help the government hear the youth.
Okay. Nina, thanks so much for that report.
Yeah, no problem.
That was Nina Zsigic. She is CKW's youth climate correspondent, speaking to us from the Manitoba Legislative Building. So listen for the CKW News team's full report on the youth climate action during the news morning news show People of Interest. It airs Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday from 8 to 9 a.m. on CKW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Now, the urgent concerns about climate change are not restricted to youth. Leading scientists have also been ringing the alarm bells. Prepared by leading researchers from around the world, the 2018 report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, was delivered to governments, policymakers, and individuals in Korea on Monday, October 8th. And it warns that the world has already warmed by 1 degree Celsius since the middle of the 19th century and could reach 1.5 degrees Celsius before the middle of this century at the current rate of warming. Earlier today, I had a chance to speak to Paul Beckwith. He's a climate systems scientist and part-time professor and instructor based at the University of Ottawa. He has a YouTube channel and a website that regularly updates the public on what he's calling a climate emergency. We started our conversation with a query about anything he thought was missing or understated in the most recent report. Thanks so much for joining us, Paul Beckwith.
Thank you for having me.
Paul, the IPCC's summary, from my understanding, is that the report, these summaries coming from the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, are actually quite conservative compared to some other assessments. I mean, there's a need to arrive at a consensus position, and that logically suggests that the most conservative positions will be the ones put forward into the public sphere. As of the end of 2018, based on your own research, the studies that you have access to, and the people you've been speaking to, what would you consider to be the most serious omissions from the IPCC's most recent dispatch?
Well, I think that the most serious issues are that there's many highly nonlinear feedbacks in the climate system, and these are difficult to model. And these are, you know, they give us lots of surprises. Like, you know, you read reports when something happens that, oh, scientists really didn't expect this, and scientists were amazed, and things are happening much faster than, you know, expected, and so on. So all of those things, I mean, it's very difficult to model a lot of these sort of tipping points. And, you know, I think one of the biggest things is that as the Arctic warming continues to accelerate, the jet streams are getting slower and wavier and causing all these extreme weather events that we see. And they're also leading directly to, you know, even greater warming of the Arctic. And then there's the risks from, you know, methane coming out of the permafrost and the seafloor sediments and things like that. And these aren't really addressed or, you know, and it's, like I said, it's difficult to have definitive numbers and say, like, it's very difficult to predict when, you know, a tipping point is passed and so on. But I think there needs to be more coverage on, you know, the risks from these tipping points. And another thing is that when we talk about 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius, the original baseline was pre-industrial or set the year 1750. And in this report and in others, there's a baseline that has shifted more to, you know, 1880 to 1910, that sort of time frame. And we've already had about 0.2 or 0.3 degrees Celsius of warming with the baseline shift. So you can add, you know, those numbers, you know, 0.2 or 0.3 to the numbers of where we are at now. And you know, I think that should be mentioned. It shouldn't just be glossed over, and you can't just switch the baseline.
It doesn't sound very scientific to just switch the baseline, but it would appear that the reason they're doing that is, I guess, for public policy reasons? Or what are your thoughts?
I'm not sure. You know, it definitely understates the temperature changes that have already occurred, and we're much, you know, if they use the original baseline, we're much closer to the 1.5 and 2 degrees than the report seems to indicate. So I guess those are some of my biggest issues. I mean, it's a very good report overall, you know, and it does address a lot of the issues, and, you know, it starts to wake people up and say, you know, the risks are really large. I mean, look, we're just over 1 degree Celsius of warming relative to pre-industrial now, and look at all of the weather extremes that we're getting, the droughts, the flood, torrential rains leading to floods, you know, weather disruption, things like that.
Getting back to the situation at the poles, could you give our listeners a primer on how the Arctic ice cap moderates Earth's climate and what an ice-free Arctic, which could very well happen by 2022, if not sooner, what would such a blue ocean event at the North Pole mean for global weather patterns?
Well, the ice, the Arctic sea ice, of course, changes in area throughout the year. You know, it forms to cover most of the Arctic Ocean in the winter, and then in the summer it melts back. So there's always a yearly cycle, and because the ice, of course, is highly reflective, it reflects a lot of the sunlight and it keeps the Arctic cold. So when there's a loss of ice, and instead of the white surface of the ice, you have the dark ocean water, which then absorbs the solar radiation in the summer, then so we're talking about the reflectivity or the albedo of the Arctic. So that with much less ice, there's much more darker areas of ocean exposed. So the Arctic is basically getting darker. And it's not just the sea ice, it's the snow cover on the land. Especially in the spring, there's a lot less snow cover on the land. In fact, snow cover on the land declined about 22%, 23% per decade, whereas in the Arctic sea ice has declined 12 or 13% per decade. So the Arctic overall is getting darker and getting much warmer. Now, also, because it's absorbing more solar energy, also it takes a lot of energy to melt ice, and the temperature remains close to the melting point. So when there's less and less ice, that energy is there to raise the temperature of the Arctic as opposed to melting the ice, which it previously did. So the ice really is important to keep the Arctic cold, and it's going very rapidly. So with a blue ocean event, the temperatures in the Arctic would significantly increase.
Yeah, I remember reading something about latent heat, you know, that the same amount of heat that it would take to melt a certain amount of ice from zero, you know, going from that phase shift was the equivalent to raising the same amount of water, an enormous amount. So you'd be seeing an enormous acceleration of the global climate threat, global warming at that point.
Yes, exactly. So the when the energy, so the latent heat is basically the stored heat. It's the heat that goes into a phase change. For example, the heat going into changing, you know, the solid ice to liquid water, and the heat to melt a kilogram of ice, for example. Slightly below zero to slightly above zero, where it's water, that heat, if applied to liquid water, would raise the temperature about 80 degrees Celsius.
80? So that, 80?
So that kilogram of water, kilogram of ice becomes basically a kilogram of water, and then that temperature, you know, the energy that goes to melt that ice into the water, now when it's heating up that kilogram of water, it would raise it to 80 degrees Celsius. So it's a huge, you know, of course the ice is at the surface and, you know, the volume isn't comparable to the amount of water overall, you know, as you go down in depth. It's just the surface. But the surface water, yes, that would raise, that would happen. But, of course, there's a lot of mixing and stuff. So we wouldn't see that temperature, you know, in the Arctic, we wouldn't see 80 degrees Celsius temperature. Water temperature in the Arctic, we'd see, you know, that small amount of water at the surface that came from the ice would then dissipate and be mixed with all of the other water. But the point is that the Arctic would no longer act like as a refrigerator refrigerator to the climate system. The Arctic temperatures, the water temperatures would rise significantly.
And presumably it would also have an impact on these belts, the Halene ocean currents that moves the hot, moist temperatures and moves it to northern latitudes.
I mean, we've got the thermohaline circulation system of the ocean, right, with the Gulf Stream coming across the Atlantic, and it's being disrupted. It's slowed down about 15%. I just saw a recent number, 15%. And it's the ice plays a big role. When there's ice in the Arctic, it plays a big role in those currents. So those currents can significantly change as there's less and less sea ice. And also, of course, the big thing is that the overall increases of temperature in the Arctic mean that the jet streams slow down and get wavier, and the troughs of these jet streams come very far south, bringing cold air very far south, and the ridges bring very warm air up into the Arctic as well. These jet stream waviness and being stuck, the patterns that they're getting are giving us these extreme weather events. And, as these jet streams pass through a particular region, there are significant consequences. Just to give you an example, in Ottawa, Wednesday and Thursday this week, it was about 0 degrees Celsius, hovered around zero. Now it's, reaching minus 21 degrees Celsius, minus 30 with wind chill. It'll be like that for 3 or 4 days, and then it's going to go back to hovering around 0 degrees. So what's happened is that the trough of the jet stream has just passed, swept, it's increased, and it's swept through the area where, Ottawa is included, and as a result, the temperatures plummet for 3 or 4 days, and then if the jet stream trough passes by or moves northward, doesn't extend down to Ottawa, then the temperatures are warm, the warmer, close to the zero. So we get these temperature swings, and this is happening around the world, and it's just dependent on the jet stream configuration relative to your location. So this is a direct manifestation of the greatly warming Arctic.
You mentioned earlier the tipping points, and basically thresholds that once crossed will propel us to hothouse Earth, runaway global warming. Is it reasonable that there's given the time frames involved, would mitigation, stopping CO2 emissions, no matter how ambitious, would that be enough to prevent that scenario from arriving?
Well, it's absolutely required that we slash fossil fuel emissions. But the other thing that people are seriously looking at, and for a while I've been saying, we're in an emergency situation. This is a climate emergency, a climate crisis. And more people, I've been saying this for an awful long time, for years. I mean, more and more people are coming out and saying that, recognizing that. And, in order to address an emergency, you have to take very strong measures. And really cutting back on fossil fuel emissions is vital. But there's other things that we really need to do in order to stabilize the climate. And that includes removing large amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere. Like actually, using processes, technologies, using different methods. We need to really reduce CO2 levels in the atmosphere. And also I've been saying we need to look at ways to cool the Arctic by solar radiation management. There's a very interesting technology called iron sulfate aerosols, and this is the idea of seeding the air with these iron salt aerosols, and they do a large number of things, like the iron seeds, the ocean stimulates phytoplankton blooms, the aerosols reflect some sunlight to cause cooling, and there's lots of other crop beneficial processes of this technique. It's just one idea. I mean, we need to put resources into doing this, and declaring a climate emergency is really the first step. It's really, you know, get people, get countries, get governments on board to really take this problem seriously. Right now they're not. They're still subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, you know, in huge ways.
Paul Beckwith, realistically, how likely is it that humanity will take the necessary measures to prevent climate catastrophe, that they will embrace this as a climate emergency, as you put it, given the unsatisfactory responses to decades of environmental and other forms of activism?
Yes. Decades have gone by with very little to nothing being done. So I think the climate, the weather patterns are so disrupted, and the climate is changing so quickly. A lot of people, you know, these reports are coming out, like the IPCC report, and things are getting very, very serious, very, very dire, very, very quick. So that's different now. I mean, that wasn't happening before. So, you know, I think it's a matter of time before there's enough critical mass of people that demand action, strong action on climate. You know, and more and more people are using this emergency. You know, climate change we have a climate emergency on our hands. We have to take emergency efforts, you know, on the level of the Apollo Project or the Manhattan Project, you know, or the Marshall Plan. I mean, we have to treat this really seriously, or that economic cost to infrastructure, you know, I mean, our civilization, our way of life is threatened. Everything is threatened. You know, we're losing biodiversity. Species are going extinct. And, you know, I mean, the reports are very, very dire, you know, and they're getting more and more dire, you know, in all aspects of the Earth system. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't think we have a choice. You know, it's just a matter of time, I think, before enough of this happens. You know, as long as people get the information as to what is causing the problem, because, you know, there's lots of misinformation out there that are attributing, you know, what is happening to things other than climate change. Like,
Yeah, I've heard mention that it's related to that it's not even – that CO2 isn't even the reason. It has to do with the sun or that there's
– Yeah, I know. Yes, that's right. There's all of these things that are coming out. So, yeah, it's very disheartening at times. It's very we're not dealing with the problem. And so that's the risk, that it just – that the information, you know, the misinformation just, floods out any reasoned information, scientific information. So then it takes longer and it's much harder to get to that state of declaring it a climate emergency.
Paul Beckwith, I really want to thank you for taking the time to share this information with our listeners.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Paul Beckwith, a climate systems scientist at the University of Ottawa. You can follow Paul's work on YouTube and on his website, paulbeckwith.net. Coming up in our second half hour, we'll be speaking to Dar Jamail, a past guest of this program. Dar is an independent journalist who made his mark as an indie media figure through his unembedded reporting from Iraq during the war launched in 2003. He's since moved to climate disruption as a focus of his investigative work and has just authored a new book, The End of Ice, focused on his travels to areas of the world affected by the climate crisis. Please stay tuned for that. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. So we're joined right now by Dar Jamail. He is the author of a new book, soon to be published, The End of Ice. Dar joins us from Port Townsend in Washington State. Thank you for joining us, Dar.
Thanks for having me.
I want to ask you, first of all, a little bit about your process, because it's kind of a chicken and egg question in terms of the decision to write the book. You mentioned something I hadn't been aware of before about your love of mountaineering and going out into these wild places. And you've noticed that how vulnerable they've been to the impacts of abrupt climate disruption. Did you make the decision to write the book before or after some of those places?
Well, the book, really the genesis of the book started back in 1996, which is when I moved up to Alaska with the sole aim of wanting to do as much mountaineering as possible and do whatever jobs I needed to do to support myself on the side. But that was my love and my passion. And but right away, because of that, I was on glaciers and living up almost in the Arctic Circle. I mean, Anchorage is relatively close. And seeing already dramatic impacts of climate change, like Christmases in Anchorage going by with no snow on the ground, dramatically receding glaciers. So from 1996 on, well before I even started working as a journalist, it was clear, like, oh, this is a really alarming issue. So that seed was planted, and then all through my time in Iraq, I was aware of what was going on in Alaska and then, of course, around the rest of the world. And so that's, you know, that story persisted, of course, and that idea kind of germinated around the time when, in the wake of the BP oil spill, doing a lot of reporting on that in 2010, 2011, 2012, then I knew around then that, you know, this is, again, just kind of symptomatic of the deeper problem, which is climate change. And that's when I knew I really wanted to do a deeper book into this. And all the while, spending more and more time in the mountains and again, seeing these very, very dramatic impacts of the receding glaciers, the temperature changes, and what that was doing to ecosystems, etc. So, it was from 1996 on, it was just this, you know, kind of really persistent, nagging issue, really like troubling me, that was there present throughout all that time, and then finally it came into form in this book.
I was struck by some of the physical challenges you confronted climbing these mountains and negotiating the glaciers and such. All the terrain you were exploring, you don't seem to approach it like some kind of macho quest to take on a physical challenge, like a weightlifter seeing how much he can bench press. You seem to embrace it as a communion with the natural world. How important is it, that emphasis, in the overall point you're trying to communicate in your book?
I appreciate you really teasing that out, because that really was a goal of mine in this book, to kind of bring out that it's not us versus nature, or, you know, that we have to conquer a mountain or overcome part of nature or something like this. It really is about communion, and my experiences through my own time mountaineering, which that's what I was doing really seriously and working as a guide, et cetera, before becoming a journalist, that I kind of had that machismo and that conquer mentality beat out of me by making a bunch of stupid mistakes and then really learning that, no, the only way to really do this the right way is to get in sync with nature, and then having some very deep experiences that way and really learning really the root, you know, that the root cause of climate change is humans' fundamental disconnection from nature. That, you know, at some point in our evolution, i.e., even predating the Industrial Revolution, turning nature into resources and commodities and trying to control nature and manipulate nature, and all the while forgetting that, you know, we are of this planet, and we are, you know, this. You know, we can't do something to nature and pretend like it's not going to affect us. We don't exist without insects. We don't exist without pollinators. We don't exist without the bears and the glaciers. If these things go away, we're going to go away with them. It's just there's going to be a little bit of a lag time because of this so-called civilization we've built. But the point of the book was to really, I think, kind of you know, show when I went into the Amazon or went into South Florida and look at what's happening in the Everglades, to really look closely at what we do to nature. We're very much doing directly, not even indirectly, but we're directly doing that to ourselves.
You open the book with the visit, or actually your return to Denali in the Alaska Range. It's the third most isolated and most prominent peak on Earth. You said you'd been there 13 years previously. Talk about the significant changes that really hit you, that are particularly of note that you noticed since you last conquered that mountain.
Well, in the book, I really get into interviewing a couple of glaciologists and talking about the mass loss of the glaciers up there. And these are big glaciers. I mean, some of these are 30 and 40 mile long glaciers, like the Kahiltna Glacier. And I get into the science and get into some numbers and talk about the dramatic loss of ice. But it was really some of the anecdotal evidence that hit me in the face, literally right when I flew back into base camp to start this trip in 2016, when I went back up to the book. And I went on a trip as a volunteer with Park Service with a friend of mine, Mike Shane, who was the ranger on the patrol that I was part of. And he's a seasonal ranger. He'd been working up there every summer for all the years since last time I'd been up there. And he says, one thing that's amazing is we now have mosquitoes sometimes at base camp. And now we're talking about base camp being at 7,200 feet. You have to fly in on a glacier plane, land on the glacier, and it's nothing but rock and ice up there, and you're surrounded by high mountains, and you're about 13 miles from Denali, and then you start hiking up the glacier towards the mountain. And to think of mosquitoes in a place like that is absurd, but that really shocked me. And then another piece of evidence from the same person, he said, we used to go down. Well, I remember one time several years ago, I went down to this ridge and we hooked up and did a rock climb up the ridge while we had some time in base camp. And I went back down there again last year to do the same rock climb. And the problem was now that the start of that rock climb was now 30 feet higher up that same rock, meaning that much ice had been lost since last time my friend had gone down there to do the rock climb. Meaning that's how dramatically quickly that arm of the Kahiltna Glacier had melted down in a very, very short amount of time, which was shocking. And then another piece of evidence came from looking across the Kahiltna Glacier from base camp, and there's a mountain there called Mount Crossan, which I had climbed back when I lived up in Alaska. And the ridge that I went up, I noticed, again, arriving at base camp, that same ridge I had used to climb that mountain before, which was three-quarters covered with glacier and ice, now was only about, it was really only the top third that was fully covered in ice. The rest of it was exposed dirt and rock. Some of the dirt was being blown across the rest of the glacier and causing it to melt faster as well. So some pretty obviously dramatic telltale signs up there. A couple of others realizing that as part of a volunteer rescue patrol with the Park Service, we now then had to wear helmets going up from high camp on Denali, which is 17,200 feet, up to Denali Pass at 18,200 feet. And we had to wear helmets for that section of the climb because of rockfall, which was also shocking because this is a place where the average nightly temperature is somewhere between 0 Fahrenheit and minus 20 to minus 30 degrees. And now you're having to worry about rockfall, meaning that melting is happening enough even up that high that those temperatures are being impacted on some days to where you have to worry about rockfall. So those are just a few examples.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Glacier National Park. In 1850, as it states in the book, it contained 150 glaciers and covered 100 square kilometers. Today, it's only 14 and 15 square kilometers of ice coverage. So that's an 85% loss. You used to have 150, and now there's only 26 glaciers. Could you comment on, I mean, other than that spectacular loss of ice, I mean, like, the impacts that spill from that?
I went out with Dan Fagree there, who is the lead glaciologist in the park. He's a USGS employee there. He's been in the park for more than a couple of decades. And he talked about, along with the loss of that amount of ice and glaciation, you look at dramatic impacts to entire ecosystems, which I go into detail in the book because I found it to be very important. I didn't know about it, and I think a lot of other people weren't aware of it, that just basic common sense things that start to play out that when you really start to consider what this means. So glaciers, for example, are essentially turned mountains into water towers, to where if, for example, when you go through the summer and then the summer rains end, and then there's going to be a glacier and a snowpack that's there to provide water for all those valleys and the ecosystems and the animals and the plants that depend on it. And then as those glaciers melt away, though, and you lose that, then you're going to have extended periods towards the end of each summer where there's not going to be enough water available to provide for those things that I mentioned. And so how are they going to live there? Same with forests. And so we look at, for example, what's happening in Montana, and this happened in Glacier National Park and around there for the last couple of years, that there's increasing numbers of wildfires, and they're lasting longer and they're more widely spread. And this is one reason why, because there's just simply less water in the water towers, which the mountains are from an ecosystem perspective. So that's one example, not even to speak of, they regulate stream temperature, for example. So there's certain trouts like the bull trout in Glacier National Park that they need the water temperature to be a certain degree, and if there's less glacial water going into those streams are going to warm up and you're going to lose that habitat for that particular trout. And then what happens to the things that eat those trout, i.e. bears or other things like that? Well, then they're going to be affected. And so you have these cascading effects that go all the way through the ecosystem just from losing a glacier that most people aren't generally aware of. It's not just losing ice, it's losing everything else that depends on that. And it, again, reaffirms or sort of reminds us how deeply interconnected all of these systems are. And, of course, we're a part of that too.
Mm. Now, moving right along, there's also the chapter where you talk about ocean impacts in the Gulf of Alaska. Among the changes we're seeing in the warmer water in the 1970s, you mentioned that there was a biological shift just stemming from a 2 degrees Celsius change in water temperature. And, you know, in more recently, in 2016, you claim that in some spots the Gulf warmed up by a breathtaking 15 degrees Celsius above more than normal. Could you comment on those impacts, the impacts that's having on the ecosystem?
Yeah, that was another thing that really shocked me of that part of my research for the book, of having, many listeners might have heard of the Pacific Ocean blob, which is a massive warm water that had formed in a kind of the northeastern region of the Pacific, and of course this affected the west coast of the United States, the west coast of Canada, and then on up into Alaska. And what that caused was a major disruption in the food web, to where a lot of the smaller fish were going away because of these temperature changes and there weren't enough available, coupled with a rise in certain types of parasites and diseases that also went up the food chain from things that were eating them. And it simply, to not get lost in the weeds of the details, it basically meant less food was going up the food chain because of this increase in the temperatures of the ocean. And we started seeing these massive die-offs. There were massive die-offs of MERS seabirds one spring and summer that went into the next winter. A massive die-offs of puffin in around St. Paul Island, where I went for part of my book research, and then this cascaded up the food chain where there were less fish available, so that the fur seals were having trouble finding enough food to eat. And then one of the more heartbreaking stories I came across in regards to this topic was going out to St. Paul Island and the Pribilofs, right in the middle of the Bering Sea, and there was such drastic impacts happening from these temperature changes in the ocean that mothers, fur seals, would go, they'd give birth to their pups in the rookery on a beach, and and then they go out into the ocean looking for fish to find to bring back and feed their pups, and they were having to go so much further to try to find fish that by the time they would get back, their pups were starving to death. And that was a really obvious and heartbreaking piece of evidence to show us, like, this is how deep the impact's going in the food web now, that even these top-of-the-chain fur seals were struggling to survive, literally, because of these disruptions in the food web.
In a lot of the discourse around climate change, I find we don't talk enough about oceans. This is like 70% of the planet, and it's the oceans absorb so much of that carbon dioxide and so much of the heat. And were it not for that, I mean, we'd see. I think, you know, as I think you explained in the book, we'd be seeing like a huge increase. I mean, I believe you stated that being the amount of warming in just the last several decades that went into the oceans, if it went into the atmosphere, we'd be looking at temperatures like 79 degrees Fahrenheit warmer.
It would be actually 97.
97, okay.
Yeah, 97 degrees warmer if the oceans were absorbing the brunt. They've absorbed 93% of all the heat that we've added into the atmosphere, and if they weren't there doing that job, then our atmosphere would be 97 degrees hotter.
Just in terms of an overview of the situation with the oceans, like the main thing that you would want to resonate with our listeners in terms of a caution in what you've experienced and observed?
Well, the increasing temperature in the oceans is, you know, it's hard to say maybe this is the most important facet of climate change, but I would say it's at least one of the most important. The oceans have been warming dramatically. The last 5 years in a row, each year has successively been a hottest, warmest year ever for the oceans to date, only to be succeeded by the next year. That's the track that we're on. It looks like that's going to continue. And that's alongside another, if not the, it's certainly one of the most alarming issues of climate change, which is ocean acidification, which is when the oceans are absorbing CO2 out of the atmosphere, and that's changing literally the chemistry of the oceans. And it's worth noting that in the all of the previous mass extinction events, one of the key drivers of them was ocean acidification. And the Permian mass extinction event, which occurred roughly 252 million years ago and annihilated more than 90% of life on Earth, it was ocean acidification that was the key driver of that. And it's the same thing as when you pump huge amounts of CO2 in the atmosphere, which in this case, back in the Permian, occurred from volcanism, then the oceans do their thing and they absorb that and then they acidify and to the point where life goes away. And we have literally replicated in an extremely short amount of time, geologically speaking, the same conditions that happened then. And so we're starting to see that play out in the oceans now. This is why even as far back as 2006, there was a scientific study released that warned that because of climate change and pollution and loss of habitat and other things that humans were doing, that there could be no saltwater fish by 2048. And this is a 13-year-old report. So very, very alarming things happening in the ocean. And again, you know, this is where we came from, so probably not the best idea to be treating the oceans as we are. But unfortunately, this is what happens, you know, that, you know, they're kind of the bottom of the refuse pile when we talk about pollution, you know, the amount of pollution that's gone into them now coupled with these very, very severe impacts from climate change. And what I saw working on my oceans chapters, both with sea level rise as well as what's happening to the corals, it's very, very alarming, to say the least.
Now, as you point out in the book, biodiversity is under threat, and that many of the medicines that we've depended on and take for granted have their origin in these plants, and that there's a huge treasure trove of you know, medicines and other important ingredients tied up in our tropical forests, and we don't know what we're losing. And you know, that threat to our biodiversity, I think you really bring home, you know, like how significant a loss that is. Talk about your journey in the Amazon and what you learned about how climate change is impacting in that ecosystem.
Yeah, I had the real honor and privilege to get to go to Camp 41, which is part of a research project founded by Dr. Thomas Lovejoy back in the 1960s. And what they did is basically take different parts of the rainforest that had been sectioned off by roads or growth or whatever reasons, and they called them forest fragments. And they started studying what happened in these fragments, because this is literally what's happening to forests around the entire globe as cities grow, as development starts reaching into more rural areas, et cetera. And, you know, what does that do to the trees? How does that impact wildlife, et cetera? And so I got to go into Camp 41 and spend time with a bunch of research biologists in there, including Lovejoy himself. And he was the one who really made it clear to me that, you know, how precious the Amazon is for so many reasons. I mean, for example, there had been a research expedition of a couple of dozen scientists that went out in a new part of the Amazon that they hadn't studied before, and they spent 1 month there. And in 1 month, they had already discovered, they had found more than 80 new species, from plants to fish to a crab to a couple of new bird species. So what Lovejoy said, using that as an example, he said, look, with the amount of devastation that we're doing to the planet, and yet we don't even know what's all here yet. And using the Amazon as a prime example, we already know for a fact, like, how many of our pharmaceuticals, painkillers, et cetera, come directly from herbs and other things found in the rainforest, or from a frog or a vine, et cetera. And yet we're wiping things out so fast in a way that, as he put it, this is a biological library, the Amazon rainforest, and we're just yanking books off the shelf and burning them before we even know what's in them. We haven't even opened them yet. And that is, I think, the most succinct way to put the imperative that these areas have to be protected, because not just for their own sake, but, I mean, if we can't just look at it from a natural perspective and see the value in that in itself, which I think is paramount, but even for our own survival, it's just pure, utter madness to go in and start taking out these areas where it's the most biologically diverse area on the planet, and it's going away before our very eyes, and that should be alarming to everyone.
And of course, one of the most alarming points of all is when we see the ice at the poles melting, when we see the impacts on these the belts, these hayline belts that carry warm water to colder areas and just sort of help balance out the planet. When we consider there's all sorts of runaway and positive feedbacks coming from methane being released from these northern from the hydrates up in these northern areas in the Siberia and Greenland and such. Maybe you could, because I think as you start to write about that stuff, I mean, it seemed to leave you feeling quite despondent when you're faced with, well, like, you haven't seen the last of it. Could I get you to comment more on that ultimate coup de grace that seems to be coming down with the end of the ice at in the Arctic and Antarctic?
I went up to Utsjoki, the town formerly known as Faroe, which is the northernmost incorporated village in the United States, in Alaska, anyhow. And I went up there to do research for my chapter on permafrost and methane, and interviewed a few experts up there, as well as talked to a bunch of elders to get anecdotal evidence of the changes they'd seen just in their lifetime. And, you know, to give you an idea of how rapidly we've lost the sea ice and probably how little time there is left to have any kind of summer sea ice in the Arctic, which is very alarming. I interviewed Wes Aiken, who is the elder of the village at the time. He's 93 years old. He said, look, I grew up in a little house right on the edge of the water here. And even in the summer, I remember sitting in that house in July and being able to look out and see the edge of the sea ice, meaning it was maybe 10 or 15 miles offshore. And when I was speaking with him, which was summer of 2017, the sea ice was between 180 and 200 miles offshore. Hmm. So that gives you an idea how dramatically it's changed. And what's particularly worrisome about that, which you touched on, is that in the permafrost that is in the shallow seabed underwater of the Arctic Ocean, as that sea ice recedes, that water is going to warm up that much faster. Instead of the sunlight being reflected up back into space by the sea ice, it's going to go directly into the water and warm it, which then causes the sea ice to melt faster. It's the best known runaway feedback loop with climate change. But then as that water warms up, that subsea permafrost, within which is frozen methane hydrates, is also going to melt, and then that methane is being released. And there's been countless scientific studies on this already. Natalia Shatova has written several, which I cite in the book, and are warning about huge methane events. And methane is a greenhouse gas, just like CO2, except in a 10-year time scale, it's 85 times more potent of a greenhouse gas. So it's very, very worrisome that this is happening. And then simultaneously on land, as the permafrost is thawing out faster and faster, it too is releasing both CO2 and methane into the atmosphere. So these two things happening in the Arctic are, I think, two of the most foreboding warning signs we have that as those feedbacks continue and speed up, then that's when the process gets that much further out of control. And so the threat of what many people have referred to as a methane bomb, that we could have a massive abrupt release of methane coming from these seabeds. Many scientists think this is inevitable and could happen literally at any moment, which is what Natalia Shikova has written about. And others who are maybe a little bit more conservative in their predictions still say, look, methane is being released, and we do see a positive upward trend. And this is certainly something that we need to be very, very concerned about.
Now, Dar, I think we're probably going to have to let you go now, but I want to remind our listeners that your book is going to be published as of January 15th. And it takes a very different and, I think, refreshing look at the whole manner in which we approach this climate change predicament that we're faced with. So I will I'll let our listeners dig it up on their own. But Dar, thanks so much. It's a great book, and I know that you've been a big inspiration to me as somebody who's been involved in independent media for some time. I mean, from the time you did your work in Iraq and through the climate dispatches for Truth Out, and this book is certainly a welcome addition to that legacy. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
We were speaking with Dar Jamail. His book, The End of Ice, is published by The New Press in New York. It is available for purchase as of January 15th. For details, visit Dar Jamail's site, darjamail.net. That's darjamail.net. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.